let's go to the core David Grush allegation is true, that there are crash retrieval reverse engineering programs that have been conducted illegally outside of normal apparatus of congressional oversight for many decades, maybe motivated initially out of this sort of, you know, Cold War fear, sort of a sub rosa competition between Russia and the U.S., and maybe that expanded with China in the past few decades. And that maybe, you know, what was, you know, this cleaving that happened in the 60s or 70s into private aerospace with sort of, you know, certain collusion with, you know, elements of the Department of Defense and intelligence community has sort of metastasized, pathologized, maybe run away from the normal instruments and oversight mechanisms in the government. And now it's become a problem. How and where and when can you steer individuals and groups in a particular direction? How can you, have certain influencers, certain parts of that social graph be weaponized to spread or even stop certain messages from propagating? So there's very sophisticated techniques at scale being operationalized as we speak across hundreds of millions of people every minute of every day. That's just the world we all live in. Human society has gone through many of these quite dramatic, you know, we call it like inflection points or phase transitions or big historical events that there's a sort of a characteristic before and after, right? There's no like end. There's just a different regime of either social, political, cultural, technological understanding, awareness, capability. So this is going to be a new version of that, you know, folks maybe in the know expect to maybe be a particularly disruptive one, and it just needs to be prudently postured and prepared for.
Have you ever wondered if your company is maximizing the return of your data investment? Are you collecting the right data required to make informed decisions? Is there more that can be learned from our data? Coyus Institute can answer these questions and help you discover the hidden value within your data sets by utilizing a well-rounded approach to data analysis. Stop leaving value behind and start increasing the return on your data investment. The next generation of data analysis has begun. We are pioneers in pattern discovery. We are Coyus Institute.
So how did you end up becoming a national security consultant?
I guess, you know, you fall into it as these things happen. So I did an undergrad in physics and philosophy, thought I was going to be an academic, decided the lab and the whiteboard wasn't for me, stalled for time with a master's over in London at the LSE, came back to the States, did kind of a two-year fellowship, continuing that kind of stall at the National Science Foundation, where I sort of tried to bridge from the academic perspective more into sort of public policy domain. And at that experience, I did kind of a number of different things, but kind of got more engaged in like emergency management stuff. And so when I was job hunting, I had some college buddies of mine that were working for a startup that was doing like war games, essentially. So like tabletop exercises, other sort of simulations for the government as part of a small company kind of starting up in D.C. I said, you know, we'll give that a try. And that kind of began sort of a meandering career through national security consulting, you know, really focused on sort of applying different sorts of quantitative and qualitative analytic methodologies to help the government think through kind of low probability, high consequence events. So I did a lot of things, both on more like the experimental side, you know, advanced technology, as well as more kind of the analytic side, modeling, simulation, sort of policy program assessment, that sort of stuff. So I did that for a number of years before doing sort of government consulting, became a little bit stale and more project management bureaucratic. And so, yeah, I got this opportunity about a year and a half ago to sort of more move into private sector consulting. So the Krevstamos Group really only support private sector clients and really advise them at the intersection of geopolitical cybersecurity risk. And so I'm the director for security intelligence there, sort of blending different analytic and sort of geopolitical insights on, you know, all the different messiness of in the modern world facing multinationals. So, yeah, keeps me busy.
What would you say are the greatest national or even global security threats that we're facing today?
Oof. Well, yeah, you're sticking your hand in the Pandora's box there. It's greatest is, I think, doing a lot of work there, right? Because some folks have a different, you know, assumption about how they calibrate these things, whether it's time horizons in like the near term, whether it's things that are most likely, most consequential, kind of in that high risk box. Obviously, you know, the sort of standard ones are the ones that, you know, make up the most of our sort of, you know, consumption of headlines, whether it comes to either escalation paths out of Ukraine, whether it comes to deterioration in the U.S.-China relationship. You know, those are kind of the major geopolitical flashpoints, nothing too controversial. Really where things get dicey is when you start to think about, you know, over the longer term, maybe 3 to 5 year horizon, what are kind of maybe lower probability events that people maybe wouldn't have on their whiteboard right now, right? So like pandemic was a good example, right? The government had done lots of pandemic planning. I actually did a number of pandemic planning and exercises over the years. So it wasn't like a surprise, but no one predicted, you know, a year before the pandemic that was going to be what 2020 turned out to be. So you might put, you know, on your forecast, and a lot of geopolitical risk shops do this. Here are the major flashpoints. Here are the major kind of structural tensions in the global system. You know, looking 6, 9, 12 months out, here's where we would advise kind of, you know, the big risk areas. And of course, you know, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea are always on the top of that list. There's sort of the economic sort of dynamics there, looking at a forecasting global recession, and obviously the worries that the financial system isn't as stable as, you know, people would like to hope. And then there's the chance of another pandemic coming out of the blue. You know, our global system is quite fragile. The structures that underpin modern life look stable, but they're quite vulnerable to disruption. And a lot of our systems, you know, are built to withstand certain sort of levels of perturbation. What really gets us in trouble is when there's some unforeseen shock that leads to feedback loops and cascading failures. And that's where you can get into a bad spot. So yeah, I did that for a number of years, sort of thinking through all the bad case scenarios, making you paranoid. And you sort of climb a curve of worry, and then you just have a certain sense of psychological equanimity that sets in after a certain point.
I suppose this does lean into the cybersecurity sector, but I'd also argue that just information integrity is probably a pretty big issue facing especially the public. Knowing what information you can trust has become increasingly more challenging, and there's a lot of effort from within, I suppose you could say, the legacy media and also from big tech to censor information on critical issues and promote the idea that doing your own research is a bad thing as well. That seems to have become something that's been popularized over the last few years. So I think one of the other issues is just knowing what kind of information is actually valuable.
Yeah, I mean, you can almost diagnose it like you would diagnose like a medical condition, sort of information disorder, a sense of epistemic nihilism, kind of sort of refractory epistemology where no one really understands or trusts, you know, what to believe and how to believe it, and sort of the standard tropes of sort of anchors of how you establish sort of common currency and democracy have been swept away by modern technology. Right. And those sorts of dynamics, I think, are only going to accelerate as you have emergent technologies, generative AI, et cetera, sort of just put fuel on that, you know, disinformation sort of kerosene fire. And yeah, there's all sorts of second and third order effects that I don't think we've been able to grapple with in terms of the impact not only on our overall social psychology and our political system, but, you know, what sorts of, you know, legitimacy, you know, our current institutions are going to, you know, face crises in. We've seen versions of this sort of, but I would say they're more like early tremors. And I think we've really seen what it looks like when you have a complete loss of faith in, you know, an epistemic foundation. And, you know, modern, you know, democratic liberal society at least have to have some common consensus reality that people have to at least nominally pay some attention to at least get, you know, over the first bridge of collaboration and consensus building that you have to have in a, you know, pluralistic system. If you don't get that, you get fragmentation, fracturing, mistrust, degradation of sort of those bonds of sort of civic life that keep, you know, our societies, you know, moving forward. So it is a major risk. And it is one that is not just like endogenous to our technology. It's also something that, you know, different actors, both geopolitical as well as private entities, are looking to exploit for their own particular interest.
Right. Yeah, no, you're right. It's not endogenous to our technology. I mean, the whole kind of divide and conquer routine is pretty much just a copy and paste routine throughout human history. But I think the leveraging of technology, especially And I would say the division and the fracturing and almost the kind of distinction of two separate realities that don't coincide with each other, two opposing ways of looking at the world that just don't mesh, has been fostered, I would say at least accelerated by social media, by algorithmic echo chambers and that kind of, you know, the problem with taking a lot of your information online, even though I'm a strong proponent of independent journalism, is that you can fall into these very hidden algorithmic kind of cyclical patterns of thought and behavior, and then you find yourself within a group or a collective that has the same belief system, and then you completely disagree with the ones on the other side of the fence. And I feel like a lot of this has been fueled by that whole kind of sweep in of algorithm and AI management of tech. What do you think?
I think you're exactly right, and it's become quite sophisticated. I mean, the development of these techniques, both from just basic psychological operations and sort of information operations and the Eastern intelligence tradition are called active measures, in the West it's sort of covert action, psychological operation, political action. You know, these techniques have been honed for 100 years in traditional media, right? How do you understand and manipulate public opinion to serve either corporate or strategic interests? And those sorts of basic sort of tried and true techniques have been amplified, accelerated, and innovated upon as social media and sort of algorithmic manipulation techniques have become very sophisticated. And there's a whole suite of different parts of that you call sort of influence manipulation chain, whether it comes to just like detection techniques, right? Detecting what an individual or a group of people believe, what motivates them. So there's very, very sophisticated and quite accurate ways of doing that sort of detection analysis, right? What sorts of people believe what sorts of things, what sorts of messages or techniques of perception management are they susceptible to? And then there's a sort of the active part, right? How and where and when can you steer individuals and groups in a particular direction? How can you have certain influencers, certain parts of that social graph be weaponized to spread or even stop certain messages from propagating? So there's very sophisticated techniques at scale being operationalized as we speak across hundreds of millions of people every minute of every day. That's just the world we all live in. It's this invisible sort of weight behind the curtain of what information you see come across your feed. There's a lot of both economic and political value in being able to steer, shape, or block, who's got control over the feed that's those people's eyeballs. I mean, attention is the currency of the day, and being able to capture that attention and steer it towards either your political interests or your products is how, most of modern society is being directed. So it's very, I don't know. I mean, that's like, I'm an analyst. I try to understand what is happening. And then, but the second order, I'm a human being who has a certain, moral and philosophical commitment to pluralism, liberalism, and a scientific method. And seeing these things occur is quite disheartening.
I mean, fear is such a powerful tool for controlling the emotional plasticity of a population and manufacturing consent. Because if you make people afraid, you can manipulate their psychology, their decision making to a pretty extreme degree. And I think we've seen pretty clear evidence of that over the last few years. But one of the positive consequences of that kind of increase in propaganda is that we are now seeing the rise of independent journalism and podcasting. I can get more reliable information on global events from a comedian hosting a podcast who's interviewing an independent journalist about important issues like COVID or Russia and Ukraine and other geopolitical conversations than you'll ever see coming from the legacy news media. And I think that this trend is kind of terrifying a lot of the political and corporate elite, which is why they're making such a concerted effort to try and convince people that, any information that hasn't been validated through official channels should be considered fringe or conspiratorial. Because, the problem is that a lot of the so-called conspiratorial talking points are proving to be true, given a sufficient enough time span.
I mean, this is where, it's sort of the double-edged sword, right? I mean, like every new technology that humankind have ever generated, it's always been positive externalities and negative externalities. And you know, one, you know, depending on what your standpoint is in the current power structure, right? Your view of the sort of net benefit or cost of those technologies or benefit or loss to the status quo is going to be in far, right? So if you go back in time to, you know, the pre-Enlightenment Europe, right? Like you had a certain vertically integrated bureaucratic control structure really centered around alliance between kind of, you know, the Vatican and kind of the feudal hierarchy that really prized control over information generation and dissemination, you know, keeping the kind of, you know, worldview of a sort of mass public pretty closely hewed to a structure that reinforced their position in society. And it took a technology revolution, right? The printing press and an ideological revolution, Lutheranism, that really was this sort of horizontal self-organized network of sort of information exchange happening outside of the direct control and purview of that vertically integrated structure. And that led to massive, you know, social and political upheaval in Europe that of course shaped the modern world. And I think, you know, the internet is a version of that, right? Other emerging technologies are versions of, you know, sort of empowerment in a participatory and democratizing fashion. But again, I see this as, you know, it's always a mixed bag, right? Like there is a value to having order, but obviously order can come with totalitarian, authoritarian impulses that can lock down society and, you know, curtail human liberty and freedom of expression. Complete disorder is anarchy, is epistemic decay, is usually decline in living standards, is usually decline in social and civic trust. And so, like, I'm like fundamentally, like, I try to find a healthy mean. I try to find how can we, you know, make sure there's a corrective balance between forces of concentration of power and influence, while also not, you know, leading to the total, you know, destruction of valuable institutions in our society, and not to sort of, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. And that's tough, right? Because you're constantly in this, you know, push and pull tug between folks who want you to be on their side of any particular issue, right? There's always this battle for hearts and minds, and which really turned into clicks and dollars in our modern system. So everyone has an angle, everyone has an agenda, everyone's using certain taglines, even the taglines that might seem, you know, ideologically disposed to you, is like, oh, I'm anti-censorship. Okay, that sounds good on paper, but, you know, like, I never truly believe everyone's, you know, a good-hearted, you know, personal, like, you know, the people always have, everyone has an agenda, right? So I try to not to slap a label on my forehead and go, you know, marching through the digital streets of our internet commons saying, hey, you know, hear ye, I'm on this team. So, you know, these are my badges of allegiance. Here are the subscriptions that I pay, and therefore, you know, this is what I'm opposed to. I think that, you know, that's an easy trap to fall into, and it's very hard to resist.
Yeah, I mean, you know, how do you find the equilibrium in the modern world now with so much division? It's an extremely difficult type of problem to solve when you're dealing with just so many different ways in which the world should be handled, all kind of competing for each other. I mean, even just with the East and West dynamic, but zooming into your own countries and your own body politic, the amount of division is palpable. I mean, it's strong in the UK. I would say it's even stronger in the States in terms of partisan division. So, I mean, how do you find equilibrium at a time like this?
I think, one, it helps to step back and have a historical view that some of these dynamics may be cyclical, may be tied to just like the demographic turnover. I mean, this is the book, The Fourth Turning, that looks at these are sort of characteristic dynamics in most human societies that lead to sort of institutional birth, maturity, decay, collapse, and that there's a certain, you know, predictability to how, you know, generations are either stewards or, you know, enemies of the existing institutional structure. And that, you know, you just have to take into account, maybe we're just in that period of time where the legacy institutional structures matured after the post-war era. Sort of the, like, you know, the inheritor generation, the caretaker generation, kind of let them decay a bit. And when institutions, you know, decay, the sort of definition of decay is that they're sort of no longer fit for purpose to the external environment. Economic and technology and social and cultural trends have moved beyond what those institutions are capable of responding to with, you know, agility and legitimacy. And there usually reaches, if you look in history, a point of crisis, a point where, you know, certain of those institutions, what we call like the modern institutional state, right, is really a cluster of institutions, whether it's, you know, the sort of media institutions, whether it's political institutions, cultural institutions, you know, institutions of higher learning. These are all sort of bundles of norms and expectations, structures of authority that sort of we are acculturated into. And at a certain point, you know, those things are, you know, sort of become unwieldy to the external conditions. And all it takes, you know, at least in the history, is, you know, some perturbation, some shock, and those institutions can really fall apart. And that's usually the bad lesson of history, is that you see, you know, these institutions come into a period of crisis, and usually those coincide with, you know, pretty severe economic, political, even geopolitical disturbance and conflict. The lesson of history, though, is that usually forms the ground for rebirth and recreation and a more healthy and closer alignment of institutional structures, norms, and patterns of human engagement that are better fit to the present and near future conditions. We saw that, you know, in a very destructive fashion in the 20th century. Versions of that happen in, you know, the past several hundred years. So I don't think there's like anything that, you know, maybe these things are beyond, you know, the power of any one individual to really steer, right? These might just be embedded structural historical patterns. To the extent that you can foster certain technologies, certain political viewpoints that you think are, you know, better in alignment with what that next phase is going to be, maybe you can sort of grease the skids. And you can shorten the period of time that sort of crisis period, experiences for us. And, you know, we have a better way of sort of navigating through that turbulence. So that's all I think. That's what you have to do. And the other thing about that equilibrium is, you know, these emerging technologies, right? Just to pick one, for example, like AI is, one characteristic variable that determines like the size and power of institutions, specifically like a state institution, is to the extent that they can monitor and control the constituent parts of the systems and individuals that it's responsible for. So when you don't have a whole lot of information or accuracy in that information, the ability of kind of the individual staffing that bureaucratic structure is pretty limited. And so that size institution can't really be that big. It can't really do a whole lot because it doesn't have that very, really fine-grained instruments of control and monitoring. But if you have really powerful instruments of surveillance and control, institutional structures can be quite large, right? This is like, and they can be done and quite large, maybe not necessarily by people, but large in terms of the scope of control over individual lives. So you might not have that many engineers staffing the algorithm, but that algorithm can actually effectively wield pretty powerful control over large populations. So the danger is that we're entering this period of time where if there is a crisis, you know, maybe the next iteration of these institutions is actually much more like an algorithmic dystopia than like a liberal, sort of Tocquevillian participatory democracy. So that's the part that I worry about, is that like if there is a crisis, which is usually historically associated with, okay, you know, there's a shakeup to the institutional structure and you can, you know, try something new on the other end. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean the new thing is going to be a better thing from the standpoint of like, you know, human autonomy. And so that is what I worry about, is that, okay, if there is a crisis, how can you at least balance the deck in favor of these impulses? And you have case studies in modern society where certain governments around the world are really leaning aggressively into how they can, you know, utilize these emerging technologies for, you know, keeping their regime in power, suppressing, you know, popular dissent, you know, monitoring every action and behavior and mood of the public in the interest of securing, you know, their...
Well, I think we saw that almost across the entire world over the pandemic years, over the lockdown years.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing, I mean, this is where, at the end of the day, right, like institutions to first order want to keep themselves stable, right? And that's just the historical dynamic that always plays out. And I think whenever there's a crisis, often, you know, there's lip service paid to other value systems, and that's often the challenge of civil society. How do you keep civil society strong so that when there is a crisis, civil society can
Remain civil.
Yeah.
Well, you said a lot of interesting things there. I like the way that you look at the kind of developmental landscape of institutions almost as an evolutionary dynamic, like an epigenetic evolutionary pattern within humanity. As we've progressed, of course, institutions come under strain, established ideas and status quo has come under strain. And eventually, if they're not worthy of the next iteration of the human story, they get blown away and we replace them with something new. Does that thing that we replace them with necessarily mean it's going to be a net benefit for humanity? That, again, is the question. And something else that you said about being able to kind of deal with crises as they come up in you know, more and more frequency as we go through our evolution as a species, we can deal with them a little bit better. And I think that's true, because if you think about your own life, you know, you go through plenty of struggles. And if you self-assess and you have a good head on your shoulders, you can start to brace yourself for the next inevitable struggle you're going to have, and maybe you can deal with it a little bit better. So I'd like to think that humanity as a collective can be seen in a similar way, that we're slowly getting our act together and piecing things into the right place, but we're also just at a very tumultuous time right now. I mean, I suppose the real problem is that we're evolving to a position where we can absolutely annihilate ourselves. And I think ultimately human beings have a benevolent center as a collective, and that we want to see improvements in the world. But I also think that we don't necessarily have the level of foresight and generational vision to see what's coming down the road and prepare for it adequately. So we tend to get slapped in the face.
Yeah, and I think you see, again, there's almost like a recurring meme in the modern debate over AI. It reveals like this larger debate or anxiety or disposition between thinking about, you know, humankind and our future as being either kind of like ultimately like a bifurcating sort of hyperbolic equilibrium, right? We either collapse and destroy ourselves, or like our destiny is in the stars.
Mm.
And there's a certain view that like we're on some exponential. The question is the exponential up or exponential down, right? And how far up that curve, whether, you know, are we going? And, you know, having that mental model really raises the stakes, you know, on anything that happens now, because the premise of an exponential is that it takes any perturbation, you know, in the first kink of the curve and dramatically accelerates it, right? And so that, I think, gives people, it's an attractive view, because it makes that themselves, it makes their companies, it makes, you know, all the sort of drama, you know, it gives it almost like a existential importance. It makes it seem like, however we win or lose these fights, is the future of humanity on the line, right?
Mm-hmm.
It may or may not be true, but I think we should recognize that that is a psychologically attractive view to certain people, that it gives themselves a sense of agency that, you know, otherwise if your view of history is just kind of this random walk messiness, that there's always been rise and fall and decay and sort of cyclical evolution and technology development, but that the sort of the stakes are not fundamentally, you know, in your hands as much as, you know, some other viewpoints would like to suggest. So I don't know, like that is it's an empirical question ultimately, right? Not just like a psychological or dispositional question. Like, where are we on this civilizational trajectory? You have to, you know, really look hard at our history and realize that, yeah, there is something unique about the past few hundred years relative to the, you know, previous 30, 50, 500,000 years, right? Like a lot has happened that has made, you know, human civilization dramatically different, that is changing it radically from, at a time scale that's very different. And that's anxiety inducing. That's you know, a book called Future Shock. You know, there's a whole, you know, I think proliferation of, you know, syncretic philosophies like effective accelerationism, sort of techno-extropianism, that people are constructing new theologies almost about themselves and the future of humanity to try to reconcile, right, this anxiety, right, that things are happening faster and that our legacy institutions aren't really providing a good map for society. And so people are left to kind of steer for themselves. And that could be a healthy process, right? People are now free to kind of think imaginatively about the future in ways that maybe were not possible and were scoffed at, you know, even several years ago, right? I find it a remarkable development that, you know, the debate about say like a singularity occurring, right? Mm-hmm. The sort of takeover scenario of an AI was kind of relegated to like, you know, niche blogs and sort of an in-group intellectual culture. And then the past 6 to 12 months has now become a topic of like semi-serious public discourse and policymaker attention of how do we regulate the development of these technologies? How do we solve the problem of quote unquote like AGI alignment? Like these are now serious, you know, issues of research and policy action. So it's moved quite dramatically along that sort of Overton window from like a niche sort of sneering subject to like a serious policy subject, which I find very interesting and sort of phenomenologically compelling as like, okay, well, why did that happen? You know, is it just purely based off of the, you know, projections that are put on policy papers? Like, and it has extensions to other topics, right? Like the UAP topic, right? Like there's something in the water. Something happening where things that are kind of in this, that are moving along this trajectory in a way that I don't think we've seen before.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that just makes me think more about human evolution and the complexities of human evolution, because one underpinning factor of humans is we've been developing technology since the dawn of humanity. Ever since we picked up a stick and sharpened it into a spear, we've been propagating technology, extending our influence using technology. And, you know, this is now hitting this kind of fever pitch hyper-acceleration with the quantum AI revolution that's looming around the corner. Is this just natural? Is this the caterpillar going into the cocoon and coming out as something else? Is this our strange chrysalis?
I mean, that is it's a fascinating metaphor. And certainly it's attractive from a certain perspective, right? Mm. Attractive from a certain perspective, sometimes, you know, other perspective, it might be somewhat
terrifying.
Terrifying and dehumanizing. That our present incarnation, even physically, is just a means to an end.
Yeah,
it is a discard. Ultimately, and I don't know. This gets back to, I mean, there's again the empirical question, like, is this inevitable? Right?
Is this
path? And we don't really have, you know, park the UAP question aside. Right? We don't have a good sample size, right, for thinking about how advanced technological civilizations evolve. And what like their equilibrium end state is, if there is an equilibrium, you know, end state, right? And I think it's very easy to imagine all sorts of possible future scenarios. That's what, you know, good science fiction does for us. But often it's very hard to reconcile some of those, you know, science fiction scenarios with, you know, the lived psychological experience of being, you know, immortal, physically embodied, you know, frail human being in the 21st century, right? Like we tend to maybe project too much into those hypothetical scenarios, discounting how radically they can be different than ours. And I trust, well, I listen to very, very smart people who, you know, I really admire, but I find, you know, it difficult to sometimes grok their postulations of some of these questions, right? So like, for example, Robin Hanson is a really smart guy, polymath, economist who thinks really hard about, you know, okay, from very simple principles of reasoning, how can we, you know, make some at least, you know, horse green predictions around the development of AI, human civilization, competition, right? Like, what's the end state here? Does this lead to, you know, proliferation of machine mind embodiments where, you know, human consciousness is effectively, you know, translated to a computational substrate, and, you know, that is, you know, then all, you know, entirely constrained only by, you know, whatever microphysical constraints there are on sort of entropy and whatever future, you know, computer systems you can create and simulate, or effectively emulate, you know, human minds. Well, that is from one perspective, an interesting, compelling hypothesis. It's also a terrifying hypothesis, right? Like, this is, and it's not entirely abstract. There's an entire motivational structure behind, you know, current very wealthy individuals who believe in a version of effective altruism, a kind of utilitarianism on a cosmic scale, that if there is essentially, you know, only goodness in consciousness or embodied consciousness, that maximizing, you know, intelligence in the universe, turning dead matter into living matter or conscious matter or intelligent matter, however you want to philosophically parse those distinctions, is like the only moral objective of our present human society. And so any decision we make now that either leads to more or less of the universe being, of our future conformal light cone being turned into, you know, descendants of our intelligence is the only thing that ultimately matters. Everything else that happens in, our, in the 8 billion human beings here is ultimately trivial. And I think that's kind of a dangerous, philosophy, because it sort of inherently discounts present value life that's concrete and real and favors sort of, you know, future hypothetical notional life at a much larger scale. And it's easy to do like the simple math and say, oh, well, there's going to be 15 quadrillion, you know, effective human minds in the future. And so even a tiny unit increment of their, you know, well-being is worth any sacrifice in the present. I think you can get into some pretty repugnant moral conclusions by following reasoning. So this is where I find it's very interesting and intellectually stimulating to speculate about the future development of human technological civilization. But I think then is an easy slippery slope to start making what could be quite dramatic moral and political changes to your present, you know, treatment of human beings that you live with today in service of this future vision. And that, at least in my experience, has been a dangerous rope to walk on.
I mean, it is a dangerous road to walk on, because human beings will always kind of leverage an ideology like that to make other human beings suffer in the present, as you said. Although I do find it interesting that, you know, and this is kind of taking it out into the more philosophical scope of things, I suppose, but I do find it interesting that you have this entropy within the universe. The universe is in some ways running down, whilst also in a process of becoming more complex. It's becoming more interconnected. It's refining its process of development, which is evident in the development of biospheres of complex biological creatures and sentient life forms like human beings, who are now creating even more complex networks of the internet and AI. And so it does make me wonder if one of our underlying kind of just baseline evolutionary reasons for moving through time is to increase complexity, to increase novelty, that we're the next iteration of nature that's even more bizarre and even more complex, and we're now propagating higher forms of complexity than ourselves through something like AI. Is this, again, just like an evolutionary, almost the ant helping build the anthill without really knowing it's building an anthill kind of situation?
Yeah, and honestly, I go back and forth, because there's certain parts of me that believes that there is yes, obviously, like, to first order, you know, how we think about entropy and, you know, the function of living systems is to extract useful work out of available energy to convert disorder into order, right? Temporarily. It takes work to maintain an ordered system. And at least from sort of a meso scale, that's an accurate description of, you know, what's been happening on planet Earth for the past, 4 billion years or so. The question is, though, whether that's to ascribe a teleology to that, right? Is that an inevitable occurrence? And two, if it's inevitable, does it have a moral valence to it? Is it good or bad? Right? Is complexity or non-complexity, like, what makes complex systems any more valuable than the other, the non-complex systems or simple systems? I'm attracted to a certain kind of physics perspective coming out of Wolfram models that's been elaborated, I think, better by a physicist by the name of Jonathan Gerard. And, you know, one of the, you know, maybe counterintuitive results from that work is that complexity is both ubiquitous and also kind of easy to get in a sense. That interesting complexity is observer dependent, but complexity is universal. And that actually simplicity is quite rare, but that simplicity generates complexity very easily. And so maybe that's just an inbuilt feature of the universe. Maybe it's actually just a full consequence of sort of the algorithmic structure of the space of possible rules that you can apply to any simple system, that when you just iterate those rules, you know, over time, you get inevitable complexity. You get irreducible complexity. And this is the principle of computational equivalence in the Wolfram systems. There's versions of this you can unpack in different ways. But it makes me think about, you know, we have a folk mental model of complexity, right? We look at spiral galaxy, we look at organic systems, we look at computational systems that we create, and we think, oh, those are fundamentally different than, you know, interstellar gas that's just sort of randomly distributed. We think that's different than, you know, just like the tides coming in because of the moon's influence on the oceans, and that there's difference, there's a qualitative difference in sort of the pattern of sort of physical phenomenon that makes these sort of complex systems more worthy of our attention than these other non-complex systems. And I actually think the lesson of this is, like, above any really rudimentary level of bare simplicity, almost all systems are fundamentally equivalent in their computational complexity. What makes them different to us as observers is, like, we only perceive a certain type of complexity as being interesting because it fits with, you know, our scale and our structure as observers. So we find certain patterns of complexity more interesting to us, but I think that's more evolutionary conditioned. This makes me then question whether this sort of, you know, evolution, as we sort of put it, is truly like special, or whether it's just a certain sort of subdomain of just the larger unfolding of the universe that observers like us have, you know, are paying particular attention to. But if you were a different type of observer, or if you were paying attention to different things, there'd be other aspects of the universe's evolution that would be just as interesting, but wouldn't maybe fit the definition of complexity that we're sort of attuned to by the way of our folk, you know, intuitions. And that's a little bit of rambling, but
No. I like it. And all I was going to say is that, you know, I suppose any observer is themselves the result of simple systems coalescing over time to become more complex systems. I mean, that is essentially what we are. We're just a highly complex bundle of quantum energies and atoms and neutrons and protons. And this is all built together to create this person that's then fundamentally trying to understand their own existence. And so there's a level of, I suppose, credence given to the idea of complexity as an evolutionary motive, because we are an iteration of evolution, and we're the only thing that we know of, at least, that's sitting here and trying to understand our reality. So are we a symptom of evolutionary complexity reaching a point of self-reflection? And, you know, is that a part of the component? Is the universe slowly getting its act together over time, and we're a symptom of that, alongside what I would imagine are probably a lot of other observers dotted around the multiverse?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, from one view, I see the brain. If you were looking, if you had this view from nowhere of the universe, right, and like the color or the intensity gradient was like a function of complexity / like interestingness, right? Like human brains would like be the brightest things, right? It wouldn't be stars or galaxies. It'd be human brains. It'd be like these big bright balls, right? That would be kind of surrounded by a bunch of dark matter, right? Like the rest of our bodies. And then complete blackness, right? Just like inert, you know, asphalt, whatever. So that's kind of an inversion of how we actually currently see the world, right? We currently see the world, you know, the exact opposite. Like roads and material objects are the biggest, most important things to us. Our brains are effectively, you know, invisible because we're in the brain, right? So that's like a very interesting kind of, thought experiment to have on like invert a view of reality. That really takes that key measure as maybe intangible it is to define in terms of complexity, and really sort of center it in your view. And if that's the case, then it would turn human brains and other brains, right, and other sort of complex computational structures that seem to be engaged in self-replication and information processing at a density that's relevant to our current scale, right, and privilege that. But I also, you know, the universe is a weird place, and it might be quasi, if not actually, scale invariant, right? And so we don't really know, like, what the universe looks like at the tiniest scales. We don't really know how it behaves on the largest scales, cosmological scales, or sort of extra cosmological scales. And so what seems interesting from sort of this mesoscale of, you know, planet-sized, human organism-sized things, and we're the most interesting thing, if you were to zoom really far in and really far out, maybe the interestingness at our layer sort of falls away. And there may be other really interesting bundles of complexity and organization that are invisible to us at our scale that are much more relevant. I don't know, that's more speculative, but all the lesson of physics and the philosophical interpretations of physics have been in this kind of Copernican tradition that's always been in tension between, you know, centering humanity versus decentering humanity, right? Like, is the Earth special? Are we special? Mm-hmm. And the lessons of science in the past 4 years have basically been in the trajectory of, we're not that special, that, you know, we're not the center of the universe, we're not the center of the solar system, you know, humankind itself is just an animal like other animals that have evolved with a characteristic history, and we're vulnerable to the same patterns and manipulations of our biology, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then there always is a desire, though, to, like, you know, pull in the corner cases that have yet been sort of squeezed out by the progression of science, you know, the exception to that trajectory. Well, actually, you know, we're special in a certain way. And that certain way is always then usually pushed into the corners of science we don't fully understand, right? And so I note that, like, right now, or at least recently, you know, there's a tendency to, like, you know, we don't really understand quantum mechanics, we don't understand consciousness. So between those two is where we're going to find human uniqueness, right?
Those are
Penrose, Hameroff ideas, other ideas of sort of, you know, human uniqueness tied, consciousness tied to quantum mechanics and the mysteries therein. I know that is it's an attractive thing, but a lesson in history is that you keep going at it and you keep finding out that you're not that special, right? And, you know, there's a hubris, though, to humanity there. I really wanted to be special.
In the grand scheme of things, yes, we're just another sentient bubble floating through an ocean. But I think that one of the defining differences between us and all the other creatures that are evolving on this planet is that most of us would run into a burning building to save another person's child. That hasn't got an evolutionary benefit to it whatsoever. It hasn't got a survival benefit whatsoever. There is a so, you know, to get a bit mushy, I think love, something very transcendental and strange, this connection and feeling of love and our emotional depth, I think maybe does speak to something a little bit more complex, but it's difficult to bring that into scientifically refined language because this is the amorphous subjective experience of just being a human being. But I find it ironic, I suppose, that despite the difficulty of trying to analyze that kind of thing, this is what underpins the majority of the human experience. You know, you, myself, and everyone else is probably more concerned with the emotional connections they have with their friends, with their family, than any sort of, you know, statistics and analysis of the universe. But science and the scientific method does not take into account the most important aspects of what anchors us into the human experience. So I always find that interesting. I think that's why I kind of believe that science and spirit in some way do need to come together, that there does need to be some form of amalgamation between these flip sides of the observational coin. And maybe as we dig into the quantum landscape and we kind of have this amalgamation with AI, the metaphysics and the philosophy that underpins a lot of the scientific principles that we have will start to become a little bit more easily refined and explainable and understandable, because, you know, that is truly what I would say underpins the human experience, is your own subjective movements through it, you know?
Yeah, and I actually, even though I was sort of, you know, poo-pooing the idea of human exceptionalism, I do subscribe to, a variation of proto-panpsychism. And it's really motivated, you know, not out of, you know, to first order, like a woozy attachment to my human emotions, but to, like, an intellectual gap in our understanding of causation, right? That you know, there's a certain bare difference that makes a difference, conceptual structure that we think is what makes, you know, physics exist, right? Like, physics, when you think about what physics says about the world, it's a bunch of mathematical models that postulate certain patterns of constraint on entities that have properties that obey those patterns of constraint. So electrons are just a bundle of mass, spin, and charge. It doesn't say what mass is or what charge is or what spin is. It says these are mathematical entities that we can model in a certain way, and the behavior of these mathematical entities is described by a pattern of constraint that's law-like, that we can, mm-hmm. you know, we can use sophisticated mathematical models to.
But what influences that behavior? What's pushing the
what is it?
Yeah.
What is the law of physics? What is mass, right? There's a sort of difference between maybe intrinsic and extrinsic properties, right? This viewpoint goes back to Alfred North Whitehead and Bertrand Russell, the turn of the century, which are also called it neutral monism. It was unpacked in various variations in the 20th century and sort of dual aspect theories. I'm sort of trying to find this syncretism between, on the one hand, you have all the pathologies of materialism and physicalism, or eliminativism, that just deny there is anything such as conscious experience or qualitative experience, qualia, such as it is. And they just deny that it exists, so just, you know, eliminate it from, you know, the philosophical vocabulary. On the other hand, you have, you know, like, you know, bite the bullet dualism, that there are separate, you know, properties, certain aspects of the world that are both the physical aspects and the consciousness phenomenal aspects. And there may be a law-like regularity that connects them. There are just physical facts and phenomenal facts, and there's like a whole separate class of what are called like nomological regularities that pin them. That's like the philosopher David Chalmers's sort of view. And then there's maybe more like, what is the metaphysics of causation that physics itself is describing, right? So physics is sort of the view of the world from the outside, so to speak, right? If you were trying to understand, you know, the philosophy of the physics of chess, you would look at, you know, what the physicists are saying about chess, and they would say, oh, here are all the rules of chess. Here are the different types of players and pieces, and here are the constraints on what those different pieces on the board can do. That's basically what physics is saying. Here are the constraints on pieces of a certain sort of characteristic type. But they don't tell you whether the board is made of wood or whether the board is made of metal or glass. Like, you can play a game of chess with any substrate, right? So physics just says, here are the rules.
And they don't tell you that a hand might be able to come down and just do what it wants on the chessboard, regardless of your set of rules that you've put around that particular construct.
It doesn't say where the rules come from either.
Exactly.
It's up to a certain extent of physics. There's certain physicists who believe that, you know, there's certain logical necessity to certain type of rules. And that sort of, you know, they sort of park the justification behind the laws of physics with sort of the laws of maybe logical necessity or logical entailment. And that, so physicists are more like mathematical Platonists. They think there's sort of, you know, an ultimate logical link between structures of mathematics that they see as more timeless and eternal and almost necessary. And then if you can connect your theory of physics to that, that sort of then, you know, allows you to plant a pretty strong flag on the ground and say, no, these are the laws of physics, because they trace back to really are much more objective or necessary structures and sort of abstract conceptions of mathematics. So that is like really getting deep, right? But we're getting really off the rail. But like, I do think
I love it.
Really interesting about how you think about from the bottom up, right? You know, we live in a universe that's kind of odd, right? You can imagine hypothetically kind of a universe that would be more like what David Hume would describe, which is like there's no, you know, real patterns of constraint. Like, you're trying to paint a canvas, and you can put paint anywhere, and any color paint goes anywhere, no matter how much paint is previously applied anywhere. It just can create any sort of Jackson Pollock you want. That's not the universe we exist in. We exist in a universe where there are very strong patterns of constraint. Whatever exists has a pretty strong constraint on what else can exist. And so the pattern, almost the evolution of the universe, is just defined by, you know, existence, you know, precluding and constraining future existence. That's just what physics is telling us is happening. So we live in a very weird universe. It's not the sort of, you know, paint splatter universe you can put anything anywhere. There's patterns of constraint. You have to say, well, why do we exist in one universe? Why are we painting with this canvas and not this other canvas? Like, that's an explanation that's required. And physics itself isn't trying to give you that explanation. It just says, we're just trying to understand what those patterns of constraint are. So that's why I was attracted to philosophy of physics, is what's like a metaphysical structure or a conception of reality that would allow you to try to understand, you know, what's inside physics. And I think there's a book by Greg Rosenberg that does the best account of this, to try to see, okay, you have these two problems, the problem of causation. What is the structure of causation that gives us a physics to describe? And then do those properties of whatever it is that underpins that sort of metaphysics of causation, it actually turns out that those share a lot of properties in common with what we call sort of phenomenal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Bare receptivity, or like pure receptivity, bare differences that make a difference, a sort of scale or unified field of information. And then there's a complicated empirical story then you have to tell, which is, if that's the basic structure of reality, how do you build up in a sort of a nest of hierarchical information kind of theoretic structures to get to, you know, really complicated systems like human brain, right? But like, there's going to be a very vast sort of tower of constructions from base reality to, you know, the kinds of phenomenal experiences that human beings have. The hypothesis in this viewpoint is that there's nothing like fundamentally different about human experience from, you know, this along that cascade all the way down. But it is obviously very different than what, you know, an electron feels.
Yeah. I think we might have hit a high enough threshold of techno philosophical language to start bringing UFOs into the conversation. So I suppose you could argue that the UFO is an example of this this thing that's painting with all of the different colors and is doing the things that we can't do. And I suppose even if we don't have a definitive understanding of the origin or the intentions of these objects, what you can say at face value in terms of what they do when they're witnessed is they dissolve our faith in science. They dissolve our faith in our established physical boundaries because they're doing things outside of our boundaries.
It does pose quite a multi-domain challenge to lots of different fields of human sort of institutions, right? Both the scientific institutions, potentially political institutions, religious institutions. It's why it is like the biggest taboo, right? Mm-hmm. It's because it is like radioactive to a lot of existing patterns of belief. So it's no surprise why it is among the, you know, hardest topics to broach in serious discourse, because everyone sort of has this implicit, maybe explicit sense that if you venture too far into that domain, you're in dangerous water. And, you know, you don't know where it's going to end up taking you. And fundamentally, most people are risk averse. And unless they absolutely need to understand it, whether it's from a national security perspective or personal psychological experience that needs to be reconciled, or just insatiable and natural curiosity, you know, the default human reaction is going to be retreat and, you know, denial until it's forced as a you know, inevitable thing to be reconciled. So that's like an explanation for, I think, why it's such a difficult topic to discuss seriously and with analytic rigor, because I think people have recognized it's not a neutral subject. It's not just like, oh, we're going to know a new thing about, you know, a new plant species in the Amazon forest. And it's like, oh, isn't that cool? And we can get the medicine out of it, right? Like, this thing would be quite a multi-domain fundamental reevaluation of, you know, structures of belief across different scales of our social and political order. So that is a challenge. And it has both the social political dimension that affects how people like conceptualize their place in society and the universe. It also, you know, has a hard technological dimension, right? Like, if these objects represent advanced technology, well, that's a proof of concept that we could potentially bootstrap ourselves with, both for, you know, maybe utopian ends and maybe more malign, you know, ever, you know, all too human ends, right? And the lesson of history is that we've been rolling the dice a few times, playing Russian roulette with the Pandora's box of technology. And I think there should be prudent anxiety about, well, if there's certain knowledge that that the humankind can get possession of and can turn into useful technology, you know, knowledge is power, and power can be used to destroy and to create. And humankind has shown maybe equivalent capacities for both. And so you'd have to be somewhat circumspect in how you approach a subject from a, you know, perspective of, okay, well, if this is going to be the new reality we unfold upon the mass public, and we start to think about restructuring our technology systems, you know, to try to get at whatever this thing represents, that's going to push us in a certain trajectory. It could be a destabilizing trajectory. It could also be a quite, revelatory trajectory for both our spiritual sense of, you know, our cousins or brothers in the universe, or it could be a terrifying one. So yeah, I don't go into this with a whole lot of like, oh, this is a fun, cool, frivolous topic. It is the most important thing if it turns out to be what we either fear or hope it is.
Well, you're clearly a very intelligent guy, and you've got a very professional career, national security consultant, cybersecurity. Why are you interested in UFOs? Why do you think it should be taken seriously?
Well, I guess my intellectual background predisposes me, right? So being a physics and philosophy nerd, I've always been focused on these, you know, more ultimate questions of existence and the future of humanity and in emerging technology. And then professionally, I went through, you know, training and then practice of thinking about, you know, low probability, high consequence events. The recognition or confirmation that UAPs represent non-human technology of exotic origin, you know, present interacting with humanity, would be the most sort of low probability, high consequence event. So like my entire intellectual professional training has made me want to think about those things in the corner of the distribution, right? What are those tail events that, you know, you need to understand, you try to detect some signal in the noise to be better prepared for it, right? And better prepared, you can think about it different ways. And I have both a personal, you know, viewpoint as well as a professional viewpoint. From a personal standpoint, it's just a matter of just intellectual curiosity and psychological preparation, right? Like, I just have always been wanting to know, you know, as much as I can about the way things really are, right? And so here's like a, you know, an apparent mystery, some interesting little, you know, little edge, little piece of the facade, and maybe you can peel it back and you can get a better glimpse of the underlying truths of reality. And I'd maybe just have a psychological compulsion to try to peel that back. Professionally, though, it's more about just understanding, okay, like, things are getting weird. Lots of systems that we have in modern society are vulnerable in very different ways to shocks and surprises. And, you know, I advise multinationals on, you know, the issues of geopolitical conflict, right? The chance of, you know, China, you know, undertaking an armed operation against Taiwan are low, but they're not zero. And if they were to undertake such an operation, it would be extremely consequential to the global system. That is a, you know, squarely in the center of the wheelhouse of what, say, C-suites and modern corporate boards are looking at in terms of over the next 3 to 5 years, you know, what are those scenarios that we need to start, you know, preparing for and planning for? Like those what-ifs that we need to, you know, think through and understand how to mitigate their risks. So that's this, I put this like on this, there's a trajectory here, right? Like, what can you prepare for? What could you plan for? What's like feasible? Like an asteroid coming in and wiping out the planet? That's something that I really can do a whole lot about, right? Like NASA's got a whole team. They can look at the sky. Maybe we'll launch a rocket up. All power to them. But I'm not really, I can't and really shouldn't devote really any intellectual effort to that problem, right? This is an interesting one, which is really at the intersection of both like the national security topic, which I spent a lot of time in, understand the national security world. And so I understand some of the, you know, potential motivations and bureaucratic structures at play in this subject. And so that's why I think about it, right? I think about it because it doesn't just come from this abstract philosophical space. It really adheres very closely to our current political structures, our technology systems, our national security systems, and the geopolitical structures that, you know, in my normal world, you know, are going to take a lot of hits in the next decade. And so I'm looking for any other potential hits that they could take. And I don't want to be waking up, you know, the day after Biden gives the, you know, that address and being like, oh, okay, now I have to factor this into my models. I have to factor this into my plans. That doesn't mean it's the only thing I look at. By no means is it like, do I just spend all my time looking at UAPs, right? I just think it's a very interesting, novel phenomenon. And there's indicators that you should be taking more and more seriously as a subject of intense analysis. And so, you know, I've been following this in 2017 with some interest that it's sort of been progressively more sort of moving, you know, closer to the center of my professional focus, as it seems like, you know, our current institutions, you know, are moving along a similar trajectory, right? Like our government and our national security bureaucracies are treating it very seriously. I don't see why I should treat it any less seriously than that. So that's kind of that.
Do you find that your colleagues are taking it seriously?
It hasn't hit that tipping point yet. I think it's still in this sort of ambiguous gray zone where, you know, it hasn't. It's like just tipping point, right? It's not like you're going to dismiss it or sneer at it, but also it's not quite, you know, and I don't think it, at least from a certain perspective, merits being like the top of the agenda, right? For like, if I'm a C-suite, like my risk ladder, right? It's got a lot of other things on it before I think UAPs make that list.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that just like, you know, being pragmatic, you got to prioritize. What's the most important thing? What's the most important problem that these people are going to face in the next 3, 6, 9, 12 months? And, you know, right now there isn't evidence this is going to be the thing that everyone has to now throw up their plans and, you know, tear up everything they're doing to refocus on this thing. You know, until I see that definitive indicator, like, you know, for example, to analogize it to like AI or the coronavirus is like, you know, areas of, say, the risk universe that have gone through like evolution of a different characteristic kind of pattern. Like the coronavirus, you know, in whatever the summer of 2019, you know, that wasn't be on anyone's risk ladder. If you were asking someone in January of 2020, you know, you get a wide variance. You get certain people that were paying really close attention to reports out of Wuhan that were either really plugged into the defense and intelligence establishment, and you get like little, you know, knock on the shoulder, a little whisper in your ear saying, yeah, they're undercounting the cases. This is for real. You should, like, you know, get ready, right? And then 3, 4, 10 weeks later, the rest of society catches up and everyone's going to Costco in a panic, right? With AI, you had kind of this divergence from the intellectual subculture to the policy community that started to converge in the past, say, you know, really 6 to 9 months. UAPs, it hasn't gone through that trajectory. It is still like on the left side of that, whatever that tipping point is, still on the left side. Now it's moving towards what may be a tipping point, but it's unclear how close the tipping point is. Could be 2 months away, it could be 2 years away. Who knows? It may never happen. But I do detect a shift, right? It's not definitely not static. And it seems like the movement is getting faster. So if I'm trying to be rigorous in looking through, like trying to detect from the little indicators we look at, whether it's Representative Mike Gallagher interview on the Pat McAfee show, whether it's Senator Mark Rubio's statements, whether it's the Schumer bill, whether it's, you know, the bureaucratic maneuvers in Aero and the DOD, these are all indicators. And I try to put those indicators together and I try to assess what's the sort of the pattern here? Is this slowing down, speeding up, stalling? And it seems like if I take, you know, a view of the last, say, 5 years of this subject post 2017, it seems to have been, you know, accelerating, which to me, as someone who is attuned to looking at those parts of the probability distribution, makes me want to pay, you know, attention and maybe closer attention than I would have 2 years ago.
Yeah, Eric Weinstein made some interesting comments recently on Chris Williamson's podcast, which is a pretty big podcast. And for those that don't know, Eric Weinstein's a public intellectual. He's very very tuned into the world at large and is usually brought onto podcasts to talk about a whole lot of different issues. But he was brought into the UFO subject kind of unwillingly. I think a couple of his friends who I've spoken to, like Jesse Michaels, I think kind of tugged at Eric to start talking to people in the UFO space. And then he was actually contacted by someone, which just seems to be something that happens with prolonged exposure with this subject as a public persona, is that people kind of come out of the woodwork saying that they have intelligence backgrounds and, you know, want to give you privileged information. And this happened to Eric. It also happened to Sam Harris. And I think Sam Harris kind of backed out pretty early on and was like, you know what, this isn't my cup of tea. I'm not going to have any more of this. But Eric's still hanging around and he's still kind of not sure what to think. And he was on Chris Williamson's podcast. I think it was literally just uploaded the other day. And he was talking about UFOs or UAP. And he said that, you know, there are various versions of this secret world that play out like a space opera, which he's absolutely right about. The more you dive into the subculture, it can become a real Pandora's box of different narratives and ideas, and people are so sure of their perspective on this subject and speak in definitives. And there's also a lot of money to be made from going on stage and making a bunch of false claims and saying that you have, you know, insider sources. And so there's a real problem with the information integrity. And so playing out like a space opera, I think, is a pretty good definition for some of the subculture. But he also said that there's an extremely sober element of the population that believe this, which again is true. You're an example of such a person. And, you know, some of these people claim to have direct contact, direct experiences. So his position is that there is a thing here. There is something to understand. But he's also stipulating that by saying it could be a cover story. It could be a psychological operation of some form. It's definitely not just Mylar balloons and seagulls. That's something that he highlighted. But he's not sure if this is really being done in a transparent, objective way, and is still concerned of a psychological operation element to it, I think. So how do you feel about the way in which this kind of unfoldment of government discussions happening? Could it be weaponized towards psychological operations? Before I let you answer, the UFO issue just in general, as we were saying, because of the ontological shock factor involved, from religion to science to economics to just so many different aspects of it, it's so disruptive. It certainly does have a high psychological warfare value attributed to it. So are we at risk of that?
Yes. That's kind of really getting to the core of the issue. I actually had the pleasure of chatting with Eric twice last spring and then earlier this spring. Last spring I was actually with Eric and Avi Loeb. So very smart, super smart, hyper smart individual. So I respect his opinion. I think he's always circumspect with the right balance. So the way I try to think about this is there are many potential actors that all could be competing with different interests. And so if you grant by sort of just to stipulate the scenario that we exist in right now is the one where this kind of the core David Grush allegation is true, that there are crash retrieval reverse engineering programs that have been conducted illegally outside of normal apparatus of congressional oversight for many decades, maybe motivated initially out of this sort of, you know, Cold War fear, sort of a sub-Rosa competition between Russia and the U.S., and maybe that expanded with China in the past few decades. And that maybe, you know, what was, you know, this cleaving that happened in the 60s or 70s into private aerospace with sort of, you know, certain collusion with, you know, elements of the Department of Defense and intelligence community has sort of metastasized, pathologized, maybe run away from the normal instruments and oversight mechanisms in the government. And now it's become a problem. And maybe there's a motivation now, a recognition that China's catching up and we're in a global domain of strategic and technology competition. And we can't just keep the secret sort of festering on the side. We need to bring it into the fold and we need to widen access. I think even legislation, it was sort of to broaden awareness of historical exotic technology antecedents previously provided by the federal government for research and development purposes, right? And then the eminent domain clauses in the Schumer bill. These are interesting indicators. You take those at face value, right? Or do you see that sort of head fakes, right? And I think you can imagine a scenario where it's both happening, right? There is the core Grush story is true, and there is a whole set of maybe, you know, inconsistent psychological operations over many decades to deceive the public into either believing the UFO story is bokum, but also make sure that they're covering their bases for foreign counterintelligence purposes. So recognizing that, you know, it's easy to mislead and deceive the public. It's harder to mislead and deceive, you know, the KGB, the SVR, the Ministry of State Security, right? Who are likely going to try to penetrate these systems and are not just going to take, you know, the Roswell story at face value, right? So you need to construct a whole set of, you know, say different layers of your disinformation operation to protect the core secret, which then from the outside perspective can be like a bunch of, you know, light waves bouncing inside multiple different mirrors. And you don't really know then, like, what's the deeper mirror, right? Where's the actual light coming from? Is it coming from a surface mirror, a second order mirror, a third order mirror? And I think from Eric's perspective, he sees this as just the wilderness of mirrors, as called it for the counterintelligence world, which, again, puts everyone in a very fraught epistemic position to try to assess signal from these apparent statements, legislative maneuvers, etc. Is this all just an op? Why are they wanting us to believe aliens are happening now? Why are they doing all these things? You know, why did the majority leader drop a 64-page bill on the National Defense Authorization Act defining non-human intelligence 22 times, right? Like, that demands explanation, right? You can't just ignore that happened, right? Like, that is a fact that is, you know, he put it on the top four things in his floor statement. He had, like, China's research technology competition, he had AI, he had fentanyl, and he had UAPs in his, like, floor speech of his priorities for this year. Why? Why did that happen, right? Who was telling him to do this? Who was telling him this is an important issue? There's obviously a lot happening behind the scenes between different structures of our bureaucratic and political apparatus, from the White House, National Security Council, Department of Defense, IC, the technology, you know, community, both big tech as well as legislative defense contractors. There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of things happening. Only parts of it are, you know, in public view and being reported on. So there's a lot of machinery happening, a lot of things going on, very, very important things to first order. So you have to account for all of that in your explanation of this, right? A lot of things are happening that are not being reported on that are, you know, obviously not for disinformation purposes for the public, but could they be done to deceive, more advanced foreign adversaries, right? Sometimes you do things in counterintelligence that are never public. They're just done purely to deceive the adversary. And you don't know, right, unless you're involved in planning that operation, whether that program that was just stood up with a what appear to be an exotic purpose was actually done for just information purposes, for a sophisticated, intelligence service. This is where it gets really tricky from the outside perspective. So I'm with him in terms of just like, okay, there is something smelly here. And you have to read the tea leaves very closely. But I think the bottom line is you can't just ignore it. You can't just treat this as being, a laughing, dismissive issue. I've heard similar things, right, from folks first or second degree from different parts of the intelligence community that say this is a very serious issue. This is a real thing. I've had people tell me very, personal stories about their own experiences, and people with very senior professional backgrounds. It's hard. You have to reconcile that some way, right? You can't just say, "Oh, you're a loon," because then I have to dismiss all of your professional bona fides in the same breath, and that's hard. That's hard to do.
Without obviously revealing the identity of anyone, is there an example you could give of someone who gave you an experience that had a very professional background?
Yeah, certainly. I don't want to
identify them.
Yeah, betray their confidences. But yeah, those people have folks in senior have been involved in say media, folks that have been involved in the banking system, pretty senior positions that have reported what you might call a classic experiencer, phenomenology. It's very hard for them sometimes for people to reconcile that with their existing professional worldviews and their colleagues. There's oftentimes that forms a psychological tipping point for a lot of people, right? It's like, okay, this was abstract, not like sort of leaning to as nonsense until one day something very weird happened to me.
Yeah.
And I can't explain it. And now I'm willing to sort of take a second look at a whole bunch of other things that I previously dismissed. Nothing that hasn't happened to me personally. So I'm,
that's something I was going to ask you. So you've never had a UFO or any sort of paranormal experience in your life?
Not really. I mean, nothing that I think would meet the characteristic definition.
Yeah.
No. I mean, I have to be. Then again, these things are sometimes on a spectrum. And I've always been like, I've had like. Yeah, I've always been obsessed with like math and physics for most of my life. So I've always had like, more like I'd say a hard nosed materialist disposition. Mm-hmm. My, like I say, intellectual development. So that entire time I was very negative on all the UFO thing. Even though at the same time, I actually read books like The Hunt for Zero Point Energy. I even read in high school like the websites of Hal Puthoff and Jack Sarfati. Because I was interested in all sorts of parts of physics, even like what you might call fringe physics. So I was following, folks at the frontiers of the quantum gravity, like Lee Smolin and Carlos Rovelli. And then I was like, okay, well, what are the people that are fringier than that? And that's sort of Jack Sarfati, Hal Puthoff. And of course, I got into like, exotic proposals, like all the sort of, sci-fi plots about, what sorts of crazy, skunk wort sorts of stuff we could have.
Yeah, you started spiraling down that rabbit hole, brother.
Yeah, but like that sort of, that my disposition was always towards like, all right, this is probably human tech that we've been able to like manipulate people into believing are aliens, right? That's sort of where I was coming at.
Yeah.
Right?
It's funny that you mentioned Nick Cook because he's a friend of mine, and I find his transitional journey through the UFO subject very interesting because he started off very materially minded with it. He obviously wrote the book The Hunt for Zero Point, and he was I think the editor or maybe even higher than the editor for Jane's Defense Weekly. So coming from a militaristic national security nuts and bolts materialistically derived perspective on this. Now he's on the board for Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies. It's like the deeper you stay in this pool and the more you wade into it, you inevitably start encountering echoes of spirituality and philosophy and consciousness. And that's the thing with this subject.
Yeah. And I'm sometimes my head is so open-minded, my brain falls out, right? So I'm willing to basically hold any idea lightly. I am very interested in thinking through, because if you dismiss something out of hand, right, you're not really understanding maybe what value you can get out of considering that idea. Doesn't mean you take it in a whole cloth, but you try to understand how it can contribute to like a mosaic of intellectual perspective. And so there's interesting, serious analytic research into the nature of conscious experience and it's sort of near physical grounding. Like it is certainly is associated with physical processes that we, you know, don't understand, but it is correlated with the material behavior in our brain. So, you know, if you look at like, oh, for example, one analogy I was thinking about is like really the most advanced, like say DARPA projects, right? The trajectory of our current research is we want to turn our human pilots into more like machines, right? We want to augment their cognition. We want to improve their biology. Really, you know, we want to just try to turn them more into more like machines. And we want to take more of our machines and turn them more into like emulate human cognition, right?
Yeah, you had the Skyborg initiative that came out not that long ago, right?
Yeah, and there's a whole big defense effort now. Big, massive mass production drone swarms, really like sort of like sort of wingman designs where you have like one fighter jet and then a whole bunch of autonomous jets kind of, you know, flying in synchrony with it. So that's the trajectory is turning, you know, humans into more like machines and turning machines into more like humans, you know, like eventually if we keep progressing technology, those trend lines will converge, right? So if you're looking at, you know, UAPs, right, that, you know, you take David Grush's allegations, you know, prima facie, you know, with some credibility, you have to account for, okay, well, he says there's biologics, there's pilots, and then there's craft. Okay, well, you know, you would have to assume there would be a tighter fusion between the pilots and the craft than we currently have in our, you know, craft and pilots. But we're trying to fuse our craft with our pilots. Maybe, you know, in 100, 200 years, 500 years, 1,000 years, you know, the distinction between craft and pilot will start to become less an important distinction, right? That just maybe like...
Yeah, the whole kind of brain-computer interface will basically just be like a symbiotic relationship between you and that technology.
And like we're currently trying to how we can, you know, engineer human consciousness, right? How we can plug machines into it or turn machines into things like that emulate human consciousness. So it seems odd to me that we would sort of park all the wooey consciousness aspects of the UAPs into the, you know, spiritual kind of it's wishy-washy, it's not nuts and bolts aspect of things, when actually it's, you know, should just be treated as a scientific and engineering problem.
Well, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, right? And that's Arthur C. Clarke's third law, and I think it can certainly apply to UFOs that we could be seeing. Are we seeing it, one theory is, are we just seeing the echo of humanity after some sort of post-singularity biomechanical convergence? Is it us?
Yeah, I mean, I try to think about, you know, if I step back, I try to be Bayesian, and I look at classes of explanation and then sub-branching classes of explanation. So like the characteristic way to think about explanation for any UAP is it's either systematic error, systematic deception, real secret human technology, or real non-human technology. And you have to have certain credences you put across those four. They're not mutually exclusive, but I think they're comprehensively exhaustive. And then that non-human technology branch, I think canonically, you know, splits into four, right? It's either extraterrestrials, cryptoterrestrials, you know, extratempestrials, or interdimensionals, right? Those are, I think, the four, at least in our current scientific vocabulary, ways of coming up with explanations. They're either coming from a different planet here, right? They're either been at the planet before us and have just stuck around, some parts of them or all of them, in a way that's, you know, evades normal detection. They're, you know, extratempestrial, to your point. They're future humans or future non-humans that have been able, in future, maybe in a slightly more sophisticated sense, not of our timeline, maybe of a parallel timeline, you know, certain versions of quantum mechanics, interpretations of, say, the Everett, you know, hypothesis, or even other brand or other, you know, conceptions of physics that's, you know, allow for, you know, a landscape of say, vacuous states, and you can just jump across if you have advanced technology. Or interdimensionals, which might actually be a version of that same thing, right? Coming from a different degree of freedom that you have to have a certain amount of technology and scientific understanding to access, right? So that there's certain degrees of freedom in the universe that we just don't really know exist, and we don't know how to exploit them. Usually, the pattern of physics now, in fact, pattern of physics the past 100 years has been understanding what those degrees of freedom really are, right? And usually they're packed pretty small, right? Usually those degrees of freedom are hard to see unless you really get smaller and smaller and smaller. We try to build bigger particle accelerators to see, are there any hidden degrees of freedom that maybe a particle is coming in or splitting out into? That's, you have to take that seriously as a scientific prerogative, right? And I think I've heard serious people talk about the sort of like temporal dimension here as being potentially relevant, because some of the characteristic phenomenology of some of the objects is not a traditional aerospace, you know, trajectory, even if it's transmedium with hypersonic velocities. It also displays other morphologies and, you know, odd anomalous behavior that seems, you know, like non-ballistic, non-inertial, maybe even, you know, coming just like that, right? Which is, again, you have to reconcile it.
I mean, there's even some instances of what looks like bilocation or trilocation appearing in multiple places at once, almost as if they're behaving like a quantum particle, like a macro quantum effect.
I mean, your guess is as good as mine, man. I mean, it is. I noted in the Aero mission brief, which I thought was, you know, again, just a slapdash kind of clown show website.
That's
for government.
See, it seems to be the consensus, to be honest.
Yeah, but it has some interesting nuggets in that. In one of the links to their like mission overview like PowerPoint deck, and they, you know, they organize themselves into operations analysis, science and technology, strategic communications, and in the science and technology sort of vertical, I don't know if they're gonna call it a branch or whatever, but they're gonna like try to bring in specialists and experts in theoretical physics and advanced technologies to help them, you know, with, you know, explanations for these anomalous, you know, behaviors, right? So that means that they recognize they need to go out and try to talk to theoretical physicists. Why would you need to talk to them, right? Like, as opposed to just like you've got lots of defense contractors with a lot of smart physicists doing all sorts of crazy stuff. They seem to think they need to reach out to like external non-government traditional contractors to figure out, okay, is there some scientific understanding that could be at the fringes of our current, you know, most advanced knowledge that we're going to need to build in to some of our, you know, analytic assessments. That's what they're trying to do, right? That tells me they're really struggling to account for some things that they have hard data on. And they need to reach for very non-traditional sources of expertise in, you know, our leading physics departments to do that. That tells me there needs to be a better bridge, a bigger bridge between, you know, our most advanced research disciplines, theoretical physics, and trying to account for this phenomenon. And that's seems to be what, at least their stipulation in those materials is doing.
What do you think of Arrow? There's been a change of leadership now to Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks. And like you said, they've set up this website now. Before then, they just had a Twitter account that they literally never tweeted on once, other than their like kind of initial introductory post. So what's your thoughts on Arrow? Are they trustworthy? I did a poll on Twitter, actually. Let me double check, because I literally did it today just to kind of gauge public perception on it. It wasn't looking that good when I last checked it in terms of Arrow's level of trustworthiness in the eyes of the community. So I put the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office is trustworthy, untrustworthy, or difficult to pin down. I've had 626 votes. 1% said it's trustworthy, 63% said it's untrustworthy, and 35% said it's difficult to pin down. So where do you sit on that scale, Matt?
Well, first, I would distinguish, you know, the personifying era with Sir John Kirkpatrick, which is hard because he's been the only director of it, right? Mm-hmm. But I would want to separate my assessment of him personally and his personal statements from what could be more like the bureaucratic, you know, structure underneath him that would survive him, right?
Right.
Were to leave the office. So I want to separate my opinions of both.
Yeah.
I don't have an opinion of Dr. Kirkpatrick given what he's said publicly. He seems a bit aloof, standoffish, somewhat pedantic minded. Just his approach to public communications is very inartful. And he's shown, I think, maybe poor judgment when he released that document after David Grush's testimony that seemed, you know, done out of personal spite and, you know, wasn't ever like a measured, you know, statement that you would expect like a senior civil servant to make. Didn't seem like something that was cleared through the relevant, you know, channels and Susan Goh's office, et cetera. So those just seem indicators of a bit of poor judgment, maybe bad temperament, maybe someone who's really good technical analyst, intelligence analyst, probably did some really important work. I, you know, don't want to disrespect his service to the country in various capacities, but he just may not be in the right role for him. At the like running an office with this degree of public salience and strategic importance. So that's like my current opinion. He could surprise me. He could change. I think Congress has been willing to give him a bit of rope because it's quite a big mission to stand up an office from scratch. on a very short timeline. I think he's also been personally hamstrung by folks inside OSD in Moultrie's office that have not been supportive of him. And so he's had to sort of fight multiple bureaucratic battles. And so, you know, maybe it's not fair to like pin all of the failure or sort of desultory behavior on him and also other people in the office that we don't know about could be, you know, throwing monkey wrenches. And yeah, we saw it with the website, right? He said he submitted it back in December and it took until now for it to get, you know, approved. So again, it's always a mixed nuanced picture when you're dealing with the complicated, messy bureaucracy like DOD. I do think, though, that Congress is very serious about this office enduring, giving it the resources that it needs. Really, you know, now that it's been finally moved up into the DepSecDef's office with Kathleen Hicks's, you know, laser focus, she's got, I think, some senators breathing down her neck to, like, not let the typical DOD bureaucrats like take its legs out. And if you read what they say their mission is, that they're going to ask for funding in 2025's PBR, the Planning Budget Review, it's quite expansive. It's not just the analytic assessment process that he described. They have a whole operations section, which, you know, at least if take it at face value, is like they're going to be in charge of crash retrieval program now. Like, they're trying to create their own crash retrieval program to do retrieval, material collection, exploitation, analysis. So, you know, you could say that, you know, if I squint and I'm like, you know, putting like scratching my chin, right? What you could see in ARRO is the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence way of trying to recreate in a more official sanctioned structure the illicit, unsanctioned activities that have been happening sub rosa out of their view for many decades. So it's like, okay, if you take at face value David Grush's allegation that a bunch of rogue saps have been happening, you know, maybe in different silos, different compartments, split across many defense contractors for many years of crash retrieval, exploitation, different compartmented analysis of materials, propulsion, biologics, whatever, you're like, okay, well, we can't let all those people keep a hold of all that stuff. We want to have possession of it officially. So we need to have the eminent domain clause. Once you do eminent domain, though, who do you give it to in the government, right? You got to have some place to move it. And then you don't want, and the premise of the bill is also we need to, you know, broaden access to this technologies in a coordinated fashion to help, you know, mitigate strategic technology surprise from foreign adversaries. So you need to create an official structure inside the government that you control, you know, as the center, you have a tighter bead on, and it needs to be able to absorb all of those materials and maybe analytic processes and maybe even personnel eventually. And now you sort of can displace and take over some of those legacy rogue activities, move them into ARRO, and then have ARRO eventually become, you know, the one-stop shop that it says on paper it's supposed to be. Now, that seems aspirational. I think it's also that's where you see the bureaucratic fight is. Nobody in those rogue programs would want that to happen.
Exactly.
To just, you know, they're not going to give this stuff up. They're not going to want to change the bureaucratic oversight, you know. So there is this big fight, right? But, you know, this is the chess game, right? They have to create ARRO first. They have to. This is also why I think you've seen, you know, how hesitant Gillibrand is in criticizing ARRO publicly, is because she wants ARRO to be the new thing, that she doesn't want to undercut ARRO, because ARRO is her institutional point of leverage against these rogue programs that have a strong interest in making sure ARRO doesn't succeed, doesn't get its funding, doesn't expand. So I think, you know, I follow the UAP conversation on Twitter. You know, I understand the sense of frustration and, you know, disappointment, and, you know, they don't like, you know, maybe Kirkpatrick personally. But I think you had to look at the game here. And the game is, you know, the Senate needs a place to put this stuff. And they need it to have authority, responsibility, and funding. And it needs to have institutional bureaucratic legitimacy. And it's going to be a painful process to do that. It's going to be fought all along the way. But ultimately, like, that's bureaucratically how it has to happen. The Senate Select Committee staffers are not going to be the ones that are going out to these facilities and then taking physical possession. It's going to be a separate, you know, SCIF and SAPF, Special Access Program facility, that a ARRO contractor gets, that then they do a secure transport from, you know, the Raytheon or the Lockheed SAPF you know, down the highway to the new contractor's SAPF with different security guards and different oversight procedures and different inspection regimes. Like, that's the bureaucratic reality, right? And so you can't move it out of that guy's hangar until you got a new hangar with a new contractor, with a new certifying official, et cetera. And this is where what I just described is kind of the bureaucratic machinery that is taking place inside the Pentagon, the intelligence community, is a whole separate layer, which is the political decision-making, right? Like, because I think there's two challenges. One is, oh, these things have been unsupervised and illegal. Maybe even some, you know, misdirection of funds took place. We need to clean all that up, right? So there's a whole set of activities that need to happen to clean up that mess. Maybe prosecutions, maybe other things. But you need to first just clean up the bureaucratic mess that's behind the scenes. Then there's a political decision about, you know, from the White House, Security Council, really, about, like, what about this do we make public, to what extent? And I think there's competing interests and competing, you know, views. I think there's one view, which is like the, you know, the thread of yarn view, which is as soon as you take anything out, the thread, you know, you can't stop the pulling of the string. And then you get to the point, as I think Jeremy Corbell and George Knapp said on Joe Rogan, they were told by people that, yeah, like, there's basically disclosure is good up until this point. And then it's a hard stop. For whatever reason, there's a view among the people that have close access to these programs that they just need to be secret. Full stop. There's no public disclosure coming because either from a national security perspective with foreign adversaries that cannot give any hint whatsoever to China or Russia, because we're at the strategic stakes and technology competition are heating up, and we really just can't countenance the possibility that China can throw 100,000 engineers at this thing, and we maybe only have 2,000. and that could be a big problem. And in the next 5 or 10 years, is they figure something out, we really, really cannot, you know, let that happen. Or just the facts of the issue are so destabilizing or disconcerting to the mass public at large that, yeah, they just don't want that to happen. Nobody wants to have that conversation. Maybe both. but that could be where you get. This is also, I think, the fundamental challenge, though, right? Because they have to justify why they're doing all these things in law, right? They can't. We don't have secret law in this country, so they have to pass these bills that say these things for them to have enough coercive force on, like, Lockheed Martin, so that Lockheed Martin's lawyers, you know, lose in any court battle, right? So they actually had to put enough things in law to move these, to move the bureaucratic systems to take the black things and move them into a different set of the black programs that are more under the SSCI's oversight. They have to justify that. So they have to explain why this is happening. But that's hard, that's what you see Rubio really struggling with. It's like, he's on this line of, like, he's like, yeah, we had a bunch of people coming to us telling us there's a bunch of, like, illegal, you know, programs that are related to what Grush was talking about. They fear for their lives, credibly. You know, Gallagher goes on a syndicated talk show and talks about how he wants to bring UAPs into the presidential conversation. Why? He's a PhD, you know, military intelligence analyst, up and coming, you know, moderate Republican from Wisconsin. He's on the chair of the Senate Select Committee, strategic competition with China. Why is he talking about UAPs? Like, these are odd things that are happening. That's going to be above and beyond just, like, what you would need is, like, the minimal, you know, sub rosa bureaucratic machinery to maybe clean up this legacy program mess and give it better oversight. But I think, you know, folks that are connected to this, like Ross Coulthard, are saying, oh, this pushback, there's a sense it's going too fast. There's other fish to fry with China and Russia, the 2024 election. So you're in this political game. The last point, I've been meandering a bit. Last point on this that I think is critical that most people haven't paid as much attention to is Jake Sullivan at the White House, at Security Council, after the Chinese balloon incident, stood up a UAP working group at the principal's level to do, you know, White House level analysis and policymaking for the executive branch on UAPs. As far as I could tell, like, nothing has come out officially from that very senior level working group, except for the Schumer bill, maybe, right? Which is interesting as, like, an indicator of where the political conversation is. I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not not plugged into those high level conversations. But I think you need to separate out the incentives and motivation behind what you see in NDAA from this bureaucratic legacy cleanup from what that necessarily indicates in terms of a timeline for quote unquote confirmation or disclosure. Those might be on different timelines, different motivations. Getting it over the hump of that might be tough. And I think the argument a lot of the legacy program people are making is that, you know, you've gone too far too fast. You've already exposed too much. Like, and they're probably looking at, they're probably pointing at a whole bunch of Chinese activity, right, that we don't see. They're probably pointing at, oh, China just surged in a bunch of, you know, assets into, you know, Alabama or whatever, near where some programs might be located, doing a bunch of counterintelligence activity. And they're sniffing around things that they shouldn't be sniffing around. So we're opening the door too much is, I think, their argument. Which, you know, from like the perspective of like Turner, and that's what he was saying basically, and, you know, and the HPC to the House Oversight Committee chairman is like, yeah, this is basically like too much. Yeah. Stop, basically.
Well, I mean, as someone who looks at the geopolitical landscape and the national security landscape, I mean, it's also a PR problem, right? I mean, at a time where Western influence on the global stage is in a pretty turbulent situation, do you really want to be turning around to some of your premier tier one defense contractors and prosecuting people and throwing them in jail and admitting that you've been complicit in a generational black money cover? I mean, none of this is going to play very well on the world stage. So there's also just kind of like a global PR nightmare waiting to happen for the American government and the security state, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a dead fish under the carpet and everyone sort of smell it. And everyone was like, well, there's a dead fish there. Got to get rid of the dead fish. But if you lift the carpet up, the smell is going to get 10 times worse. But the only way you get rid of the dead fish is by lifting the carpet up.
Yeah.
And there's a debate. Do we lift the carpet now or next year or 5 years? People, the dead fish that doesn't want to be seen is saying, don't lift up the carpet or really stink up the joint, right? And that's the politics right now. And I think that's why Ross Coulthard is talking about how this ultimately is about, you know, phone calls and written letters to senators. It's like they're the one people who have the sort of instruments of coercive bureaucratic force. The geopolitics is very interesting. I will point to also in that Arrow mission brief, there's only one external link. It's an odd link in, I think it was on the S&T page, under like, you know, reference to foreign adversary and allies, you know, undertaking their own efforts to try to identify and exploit UAPs.
Right.
And the link is to an article from 1991 in a Chinese state website calling for international cooperation on UAPs or UFOs at the time. It was very odd to have Arrow put a link to an old Chinese website calling for UFO worldwide collaboration.
You think they're trying to signal there, like, look, China's been involved for a long time on this. It's time to pull our boots up.
Yeah, I mean, it's very odd. I mean, I don't know what it's trying to signal. It could be trying to signal to the Chinese that we know about their programs. It could be also opening a door that maybe someone from Arrow who's responsible for international coordination is like, we want to have a conversation with you. You know, there's a lot of U.S. official Chinese delegation meetings happening, right?
Since,
you know, CIA director went, you know, Secretary Blinken, Secretary of Treasury, now Raimondo, John Kerry. There's attempts to try to patch up a very fraught geopolitical relationship. Maybe this is like underneath the umbrella of trying to, because there's certain parts of the U.S. intelligence and defense establishment that are really worried about U.S.-China conflict the next few
years.
Like, really worried. And there's some of them are like, eager for it to happen, like let's fucking go, right? Like there's others that are like we need to like pump the brakes and try to build bridges, and there's this tension. And I think the interesting thing about the UAP conversation is that, you know, if there's very few things that can kind of come deus ex machina and like change the strategic chessboard and fundamentally shift like patterns of, you know, national interest and strategic alignment, the like common declaration and like coordination around an external, you know, this is the Gorbachev sort of sort of Reagan, you know, thing was like, oh, if we were both threatened, right, we would have each other's backs, right. I don't know how much to play that out, but like there is two tensions here with the UAP thing if you take it as a real thing that's both people are competing over to try to get a technology advantage. So intense, like above WMD level strategic technology interests, right? We built a department of secrecy and separate law just to protect nuclear weapons secrets, like nuclear weapon design information.
Well, there was a Canadian document, and I can't remember the whole thing, but there was a Canadian document, official Canadian document, that did say that the UFO issue was of a higher magnitude of national security importance than the Manhattan Project.
And that makes that's what I would do, because lesson two is that physics wins great power war. Whoever's got the most advanced physics can create the most strategic technology that, you know, we saw with the bomb is game changing. And so all of those, that entire military industrial complex that was forged in World War II, if there's one lesson they learned, it was all the people that we know, right? Vannevar Bush, and, you know, we saw Oppenheimer movie, right? Like, this is where we need to focus, you know, our most acute strategic interests, is making sure no one gets a strategic physics surprise on us. And that would be especially acute if you have physical evidence of some physics surprise waiting out there that everyone is now racing to get. That would turn the dial up on the technology competition and intelligence and counterintelligence anxiety, like, as far as it goes. Just like looking at what we saw in the Shewer bill, they make the allegation that UAP-related information was improperly classified under, you know, Atomic Energy Act secrecy provisions to prevent public disclosure and other sharing across the intelligence community, because getting access to, like, restricted data is extremely difficult for anyone who's doesn't have a Q clearance, which is the vast majority of people inside even the intelligence community in the Defense Department. It is a compartment within a compartment you can have in the black programs inside the Department of Energy. So you can hide a lot of stuff there that no one knows about. So it makes a lot of sense, right? But it would also explain why there's an intense anxiety about opening up too much. I think the counter argument that we saw in the sense of Congress in the SSCI amendment was that, you know, we're worried that they haven't made progress, that it's been locked away. You know, the bigot list is only so many people long, and they haven't figured anything out. Meanwhile, China's like going gangbusters, throwing thousands of people in their programs, and we're like, they might figure something out before us. And so this legacy, you know, shenanigan, you know, off book stuff ain't gonna cut it anymore. Like, the strategic stakes have changed. And I also think the political economy has changed potentially. Like, it used to be the defense contractors were the big shots in DC, Lockheed, Raytheon, Boeing, et cetera, when it came to matters of national security and defense policy. Now you have the big tech giants, Microsoft, Google, NVIDIA. You know, their argument is that we're on the cutting edge of strategic technology competition. You know, Eric Schmidt, former chairman of Google, is like, you know, this with the DoD and all advanced emerging technology stuff, AI, et cetera. So you could put yourself in a certain position where you're like, imagine you're someone in big tech connected to strategic technology, you know, competition stuff with DoD and the IC, and you find out that Lockheed and, you know, these like legacy defense primes have had this alien stuff tucked away for many years.
Right.
You're like, these are the Bobs and the Bobberts, you know, with their suspenders and their pocket calculator stuck in Mojave Desert.
Like, you know, give it to the new kids. Give it to Silicon Valley. Give it to the tech.
Like, you've got nowhere, you know, like, quit, and the game has changed. Like, we can't futz it around anymore. So I could imagine their argument is that, you know, awareness of historical technology antecedents previously provided by the federal government, right? So that could also be a game being played here. Is there's other folks who want in. Doesn't mean everyone gets in. Doesn't mean the rest of us get in. But it means more of those interests get placated, and they have big lobbying dollars.
Have they gone nowhere, Matt? You know, that's the thing. Have they gone nowhere? Is this one of the things that's kind of noticeable on the world stage in terms of technological evolution? Is so many different elements and sectors and factors of human technology have developed in leaps and bounds for the public. But propulsion and energy generation have pretty much maintained the same level of innovation. I mean, obviously, there have been developments on thermal combustion and chemical propulsion systems, and obviously the military leverages a lot of that. And we have space agencies that are using kind of ion thrusters. But we have these little glass boxes in our pocket that connect us instantaneously to everyone. We're on the verge of giving birth to something that could almost be called a sentient AI. We've got quantum superiority around the corner. but propulsion and energy have moved at a snail's pace in comparison, which makes me think, and especially when you look at the 1950s and you start looking at how a lot of the conventional physicists at that point were going, yeah, gravity. Gravity is the next thing. Gravity generation, gravity control, gravity manipulation. This is going to be the propulsion of the future. Then suddenly, bam, it all goes black around the same time as, you know, this flap of UFOs is starting to plague America. And you start wondering if perhaps we have made developments in the secret world, in the classified black budget world, with novel and exotic propulsion methods. I mean, what do you think? Do you think they're literally starting at square one with this stuff? Or have they got things we would believe would be alien technology, but is in fact human?
Yeah, and there's many more, but there's two ways you could branch. One is the Corso thesis,
right?
We actually have all these
subtly integrated into society.
Yeah, and we're like rolling them out in a deliberate fashion, and we're just waiting to, you know, we're holding back, you know, some of the big ticket things, mm-hmm. right? Let society adjust, right? That would be the kind of the Corso, kind of maybe thesis. Then there's a thesis that, you know, it's just narrow to just like propulsion breakthrough, or just the physics research. Because, I mean, it's not honestly a package deal, right? Certain things are easier to figure out than others. You know, there is an obvious sort of mystery, which is why did, you know, fundamental physics essentially stall in the 1970s? This is, you know, what Weinstein also sort of laments, is that, and even Peter Thiel, his sponsors, you know, the world of bits has made a lot of progress. The world of atoms hasn't caught up. Why is this? Is this a cultural reason? Is this just the nature of, you know, physics that we're just stalled and it's very hard to figure out the next thing? You know, I think Weinstein in his more conspiratorial moments, and I have some sympathy for this, although it's entire speculation, is, yeah, because I saw that same, I've read in that same history of early physics. Even Dirac and leading physicists were really focused on, you know, thinking about degrees of freedom that we can exploit from general relativity. This was the natural pattern of research that you would look at post-1940s into the 50s. And there were big conferences stood up, entire research programs. You know, there was actually quite a big connection from Edward Witten's father, who was associated with the predecessor company for Lockheed Martin, R.L. Martin, who basically sponsored Ed Witten's father, who's the granddad of string theory, to, you know, help organize, you know, physicists to come to these conferences, et cetera. So there's a big pattern of research, and you're right, it just kind of stalled. If you correlate that to Nick Pope's book, I mean, not Nick Pope, Nick Cook.
Yeah.
The zero point, yeah, there was a lot of, you know, aggressive early aerospace design efforts into non-traditional propulsion systems. Yeah, and it just sort of went out of fad, right? It just sort of went out of favor. And then, you know, particle physics kind of became the focus area. We went all into, you know, high energy colliders. That was where all the money went. And then string theory kind of blossomed in the 80s, and that's sort of been the dominant paradigm for the past 40 years. Somewhat disconnected from physical reality. No technology to speak of coming out of string theory. So physics is kind of like sort of went off in its own somewhat ethereal direction. Physics in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s was like this with the national security state and directly connected to advances in strategic technology, military relevant technology. And then it sort of split, and it was the computer paradigm and the sort of research on, you know, what we can do with the computer that was really the main locus of defense relevant sort of fundamental research. So you could tell a counterfactual history where actually it didn't stall. It just went underground. And yeah, you can speculate till the cows come home. I find it very fascinating to see, like, okay, like, how would you do that, right? How would you? It's because it's, you can, like, I just for, you know, cards on the table, I've held TSSCI clearances. So I've been briefed into very sensitive programs, nothing UAP related, just for the record. But, like, it is easy to keep specific facts and reports things secret. Like, even post-Snowden, those things, like, if you want to really keep something secret, you can keep it secret. But an idea, like an equation, somewhere else can rediscover, right? Like, you can't just keep ideas in the, like, there's not just, like, one genius who figures everything out, right? People are smart all around the world. And so the idea that you could keep fundamental physics research permanently in the box it seems.
Yeah, this is where you have to invoke some sort of transnational cabal that has a controlling interest over it and would find you and would bribe you or would kill you. And, you know, people believe that, but I don't really know where I sit.
Yeah, you have to imagine. Again, this is where, back to my canonical explanation, right? Like, systematic error, systematic deception, real human technology, real non-human technology. It's a combination of two and three, where you have to imagine there's a, you know, if you have secret human technology, you're going to have systematic deception, right? The question whether those are being, you know, conducted by an official government agency or a non-official off-books cabal, as you would say, right? So an alignment of interests, private interests, right, that have access to strategic technology and be able to keep it secret for many decades. Very possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say the epistemic bar is higher for that possibility than just it's an utter mystery to us, right? Like, I think we would want to believe that we figured some of this stuff out and we've got secret flying machines that can do crazy stuff like the Tom DeLonge books, right? In his telling of this, you know, fictional narrative, this is kind of the story. There is this sort of, you know, private interest group that has made this secret technology breakthrough that have been weaponized. Then there's the government trying to catch up, and there's sort of this sub rosa competition between these different stakeholders behind the scenes. And this is part of the larger narrative of UAPs, et cetera, being real, but there's also a mix of human technology, you know, derivatives in there. I don't know. That's his story. Maybe he's been told that. Maybe he believes that. Maybe there's some basis for that. Maybe that's all part of this deception operation, right? Who knows? But I do think, though, there is, you know, there's probably something you wouldn't learn nothing, right? Like,
right.
You say someone back to ancient Greece, right? They wouldn't, like, they would know that it's not a normal rock, right? They would probably be able to test some of it out, right? Maybe you send it back with the battery on, they'd be able to turn it on, they'd be able to, like, maybe do some certain things. They won't understand how to send an email, what an email was, how to make a phone call. But if they press the right buttons, and then all of a sudden, like, the camera opens up, and now there's a picture of whatever the thing, whatever the phone is pointing at, they'd be able to deduce there's a function in the phone that somehow makes a match or mirror of whatever is on the other side of that thing. And then able to look at the object, oh, that must be where it's doing that. They wouldn't understand the physical principles of how it's doing it, but they might be able to characterize some of the functional phenomenology. And that might inspire you to create a camera, right? It might inspire you, you know, hundreds of years later when you figured out other things to do with fundamental physics, or maybe it inspired you to do other things that are more tangible. So there could be like inspiration that we get from this, right? Like, technology is not this like linear thing. It's like, oh, that's possible. Now let me look at what I can do that is like that. And that maybe is a spark of innovation. So this is where it's not like, oh, you're literally like copying the wire diagram, right? It's much more like, oh, you now have a proof of concept.
Mm-hmm.
Give it to the geniuses. What do we know how to do that's close to this, right? And that could be very powerful.
Well, I wonder about that the concept of going back in time and giving a piece of high technology to your ancestors. I mean, that's an idea people have toyed with a lot over the years, and I think that with the UFO subject, maybe there's an element of that. I mean, one thing that people comment on a lot, which is a fair comment to make, is if these are trans-dimensional, you know, beyond next generation space capable platforms, why are they crashing? And I've always had a couple of rebuttals to that, which is that, well, for example, they might not be crashing. We might have a exotic weapon system, some form of electromagnetic Tesla derived death ray type situation that can disengage these vehicles. Maybe we do have some classified weapon systems that can disengage these vehicles. Or obviously, there's the archaeological perspective. Perhaps some of these things were dug up and recovered. But when you hear Grush talking about biologics, obviously inferring that there were pilots with some of these recoveries, it makes you wonder, are they being shot down? Are they crashing? Or are they purposefully dropping these things onto our planet, like giving the iPhone to the ancient Greeks? And maybe this is part of some weird evolutionary experiment, like just throw this thing down and see if they can figure it out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we're so stepping back, like my mental model is I start in the sort of Bayesian forest clearing where I have like high fidelity credences in what I'm looking at, which are things like public statements on the record, known historical documents, you know, things that are happening in Congress, et cetera. And then I go out into the dark forest to speculation. Yeah. The bridge into that forest is sort of things like David Grush and other sort of official people with high, you know, bona fides and credibility that, you know, bridge you into the dark forest and give you anchor points for speculation about these hypotheses, right? And that's where you look and hang on what, you know, Ross Coulthart is saying that maybe, apparently serious people are telling him. It's why you hang on what Tom DeLonge is saying, because apparently serious people are telling him this, which you hang on Lou Elizondo and Christopher Mellon and all these individuals. You try to you look at all their different statements and their speculations and their intimations and their winks and their nods, and you try to get a hint of which path through that dark forest of speculations is more reliable or more, you know, you put more credences on. One of the pieces, though, I think people underplay in looking at the you know, the open clearing is the Arrow data, right? And it doesn't say a whole lot, but it says some things. It says, I think like 47% of the observed morphologies are orbs. And I think another 17% are lights. And then a tiny sliver is usually split across other shapes, pyramids, like polygons, tubes, cylinders, which is interesting, right? That like the orb, and he brought up the orb is in the logo. There's orbs everywhere. So like the orb is like the thing.
Right, it's what I saw, man. It's what I saw.
It's not the Tic Tac. It's not the classic UFO with a little bell shape. It's an orb. It's a light orb. That's the thing that the official reports are emphasizing. It's what a lot of observers report. The behavior of these orbs, they didn't give a lot of specific like characteristics. The size of the orbs, their speeds, their frequencies, the radio, IR, et cetera, signatures. So there's a lot of effort going into characterizing these orbs. What are these orbs doing, right? And I don't want to dodge your question. This is like trying to get back to it. It's like, well, we don't have data on what sorts of objects are being retrieved, right? Like, what's the distribution of shapes? Like, one very interesting thing I would want to know at a very high level, it probably wouldn't have to be classified even once they acknowledge the crash reels are happening for real, is give us the distribution of characteristic morphologies of the things that we're seeing, you know, cross domains. Then give us the distribution of shapes we're seeing in the crash retrieval program. Are those different at all, right? Which would be an interesting observation, and especially the concentration of shapes or characteristic morphologies that are in the crash retrieval that are not in the what we're seeing flying around. One inference you could speculatively draw if those were very different is that these things may be in opposition to each other, right? Some of the things we're seeing flying around at different things are causing these other things to crash, right? So this is where I think people need to broaden their aperture in terms of hypothetical explanations for this, right? If you assume these things are real non-human technology, they might represent multiple origins with different interests. Mm-hmm. Some might be interested in protecting this nascent Homo sapiens species that's going on this, you know, technological journey of exploration and maturity. Others might be coming from a different place looking to exploit and cause harm or whatever here. And if that's the case, then yeah, you would expect there to be things that come out of the sky that...
Right, so these crashes could almost be the, you know, the remnants of a conflict that's just beyond our comprehension.
Yeah, they're dogfighting, and this is the stuff, right? So then where I think people, we always want to reach to an explanation and to try to resolve the issue in our heads. It can be very complicated. The underlying truths could be quite nuanced and messy. And I don't think we can anchor too heavily on anything. And I think one kind of meta statement of epistemology is that when you don't have very high credences across a bunch of alternatives, and when you have low evidence, that's equivalent to saying you have low credences, like a low amount of like hard evidence, you actually should update pretty radically, pretty quickly with any new evidence. But that means that you don't stick to any one explanation very easily, because it means that you should shift pretty quickly. It's like pretty easy to slip across. So if we get a tiny little bit of extra evidence, say from Arrow's, you know, observations of characteristic morphologies, that should force us to update pretty dramatically. Like, we talk a lot about the Tic Tac because that's been like one of the most, you know, reported stories. That makes everyone think the Tic Tac is the characteristic morphology. And think about, well, who's driving the Tic Tac? What do they represent? What does that technology represent? Like, how fast does it move? And was it docking with something, you know, underwater etc. Important story. But almost half of reports are these orbs. What are the orbs doing? Like that's I want to know, right? And I think, you know, we should take a hard look at these orbs. That seems what Arrow is telling us. It's like literally in all of their iconography, it's all these orbs. Is that there's gotta be a reason behind that?
Well, dude, I mean, that's what drove me towards the subject. You know, I had experiences with orbs, and so I can understand and I appreciate that there's a level of interest towards that, because that's something that I specifically would like some level of answers to.
As would I. I think most of the national security apparatus. Because one of the odd circumstances we find ourselves in is like a bit of cognitive dissonance, and maybe it's intentional, is there seems to be an effort to both move as far as and as fast as possible in like an official manner to create collection systems, analytic systems, formal bureaucratic reporting structures to try to solve this apparent national security issue, while at the same time they don't want anyone to really think it's being taken too seriously.
Right.
Like, they don't really want to draw much attention to it. Right? Like, and that's an odd thing, right? Because it makes it, like, I've had conversations with folks that are, like, national security journalists in the D.C. area where I live, and they're all on this sort of knife's edge because they see the same indicators that I see. Like, why did the Schumer bill happen? What is this stuff happening inside Arrow? What is this guy David Grush saying? But then they go, like, I can't go out and just like lean. Like, my editors are like, might be a little bit of smoke. Wait till there's fire. So there's this kind of like, there's still this like hesitation to go that extra distance. The other challenge is that a lot of these reporters are, you know, somewhat dependent on having access to those agencies for their normal job. And this topic is not something that those agencies, I think, for the most part, want to be aggressively reported on, to say the least. So it makes it hard to expect like traditional mechanisms of accountability to obtain in the national security reporting system. So it's important why, you know, there's other directions of pressure on, you know, other both media and parts in the government to demonstrate this interest is there. Because otherwise, I think you can imagine a scenario where, you know, Arrow gets fully funded. They do all this stuff. It's really important. SSCI is really happy. They're getting fully briefed. They might even get all the Lockheed stuff moved around, or whoever owns this stuff. They might, you know, all of those legacy issues resolved once and for all. Maybe even some people get arrested. They even get prosecuted, you know. But nobody knows why. Nobody knows what's happened. It just, and everyone moves on. Like that is a scenario you have to consider. You know, the other, you know, countervailing potential is there's some other clock ticking that's driving this. It may not just be China technology anxiety. It may be exogenous to humanity, right? And that's out of their hands, and then they need to put things in place to prepare bureaucratic and cultural systems on a timeline that's out of their control.
Speaking back to what I was saying a while ago about hearing whispers on the breeze from people in intelligence circles, I mean, that's something that I've been told by people who are in the intelligence community. That's something Ross has been told. That's something a lot of people have been quietly told, is that there is some level of event. That's how it's been categorized to me, an event. And I don't know how I feel about that level of prophetic kind of proclamation about it, but ultimately this phenomena, if it is a phenomena spectrum, which I think it likely is a spectrum, it holds the cards. It could come down anytime. It could make itself known instantly, you know? So maybe there is a level of control that's completely outside of the government, and maybe some elements of the government know that and feel like they need to start preparing people. I mean, it's not just government. It's like you mentioned before, the Vatican Church. The Vatican's doing the same thing, you know, preparing its flock, so to speak, for the idea that, hey, look, you know, if there are other intelligences out there, they're brothers and sisters and children of God, just like you. So does someone know something? And we're just sitting here like a bunch of schmucks waiting for it to happen, you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I try to be, again, you're trying to reason in a low information domain, which is always
neat.
Well, you try to do your best to at least, you know, hopscotch on the more firm epistemic anchors as you drift off into the deeper waters. And one way to do that, at least on that particular issue, is, well, one, resist the temptation to think in like an apocalyptic manner, which is like usually the default is like, oh, there's the end of the world, because then we have a certain disposition to eschatological thinking in both religious as well as in other belief systems. And I think ufology is vulnerable to this, that there's some culminating event that will be all of our labors and our wandering in the wilderness.
I mean, it's a sci-fi revision of Judgment Day or something like that, you know.
This will be the grand revelation in both maybe spiritual and epistemic terms.
Yeah.
And I just don't think, I mean, it could happen, but like my default is it's usually not like that. it's usually something important, but usually isn't the end of a story. It's usually just like a phase transition to some other pattern, right? Like human society has gone through many of these quite dramatic, you know, we call it like inflection points or phase transitions or big historical events, that there's a sort of a characteristic before and after, right? There's no like end. There's just a different regime of either social, political, cultural, technological understanding, awareness, capability. So this is going to be a new version of that, that, you know, folks maybe in the know expect to maybe be a particularly disruptive one, right? But isn't like the end of whatever, right? And it just needs to be prudently postured and prepared for, right? Like if you knew that 9/11 was going to happen, you couldn't do anything about, right? Like you probably would do things differently, right? If you knew that coronavirus was coming, if you knew that a whole bunch of maybe, you know, highly disruptive events, you know, were coming, and maybe they're outside of your control, like you would do your best, right, within your instruments of power, you know, to try to prepare systems for that eventuality. And you know, part of my thing is like if that's the case, I don't know what they know, but I think they're maybe doing a bad job, right? I don't think the people are necessarily in charge of the secret, if that's what they are experts in all these different complicated domains and are really good at protecting secrets, probably really good at counterintelligence, maybe good engineers, project managers, secret keepers. Are they good sociologists, economists, market stability, you know, analysts, geopolitical practitioners? You know, human psychology,
which is why the conversation needs to be opened up, because not every situation can be handled by one type of personality.
Yeah, and you can easily imagine there's a certain. I mean, I've dealt with some of these people who have lived in the hermit kingdom, as you might call it, right? And they spend their entire lives cocooned in the shell of secrecy, and it tends to psychologically separate you from the wider society. It gives you a superiority, a sense of that you know things that other people don't know. And then also you're in a position of like paternalistic benevolence, that I'm doing this on your behalf. It's been
right. You poor children. You have no idea how the world works.
Yeah. And that extends across lots of different domains. Apparatus of official secrecy. I can imagine it being hypercharged if you were granted access to this secret, which would be the most consequential of all. And you could easily convince yourself that, you know, other people aren't ready for it. I'm special, so I am the one who needs to know this, and I'm here, you know, I'm knighted by some, you know, maybe even divine providence to be in this position. I think there's some people who believe that there's reason why they're in charge of this secret, and they're supposed to guide the rest of us. I don't know. My lesson is that humanity, most people aren't special. So, you know, you're probably not smarter or more psychologically stable than the average person. I mean, yeah, it is what it is, you know. But I do suspect that might be part of what's going on.
Yeah. Before we wrap up here, and by the way, Matt, it's been a great conversation, very intellectually stimulating. I think people are going to find a lot of use out of this conversation. So thank you for taking so much time to speak with me. But before we wrap up, you mentioned Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon. Now these are two individuals who, you know, essentially jump-started the public government conversation on UFOs back in 2017, have been consistently leading the charge on drafting of legislation and just rallying support in the background within Congress to get more information out into the public. Why do you think these two have been absent from congressional hearings? I think I speak for a lot of us when I say I'd be really interested in seeing these guys under oath talking about what they know in a congressional setting. So despite all of the steamrolling of the process we've seen over the last few years, why do you think they're not coming out on the congressional front?
It is very odd, right, given how center they've been from the beginning, that they haven't had the chance to officially disgorge their knowledge. And either they might have given secret testimony, we wouldn't know about it. But yes, I think for all of the podcasts Lou has done, right? Like,
exactly.
Had a shortage of opportunities to do that, you know, in front of an official body. I don't know. I mean, there was the rumor that there'd be more potential witnesses at the House Oversight Committee, up to six. Lou was in D.C. at the time, was seen in the halls of Congress. Maybe something happened to pull him back from that. I know, you know, I don't know. This entire speculation. If I had to suspect, at least Christopher Mellon is a guy who I think prefers to be behind the scenes. I don't think wants to be the one.
No.
I think he prefers to be the one doing meetings with the staffers, giving them the roadmap, helping them, you know, sear through, and then, you know, introducing, you know, high fidelity witnesses to them. Lou might be a special case, right? Because Lou is also, he has a lot of personal, like, issues tied up with this whole process, right? He's got, you know, probably different investigations going on and potential reprisals against him from, like, the 2017 era. He's got his book coming out this fall, so maybe his publishers were like, wait. Like, it's like, don't, you know, jump the horse.
Tell you what, I mean, I hope that's not true.
I don't know, man. I mean, when you get to the, this is the change. This is the, I mean, I don't impugn anyone's motives here, but like, it feels, he left a pretty, you know, solid government career, and the CTSA thing didn't work out as much as they planned. You know, doing UFO podcast circuit does not pay the bills, right? Like, I don't begrudge him writing this book and trying to use it as much as he can to, you know, keep his rent checks paid. But it could be a matter of timing, right? Like, it seemed that, you know, there's been the official movement on the NDAA side of things. Like, every year, that's usually where a lot of the energy, I think, is like, for all the jibber jabber you can have in a congressional, you know, testimony, at the end of the day, it's a 24-hour news cycle, and then people forget it, right? What endures is what passes in law. It's what the government is constrained to abide. And that is much more strategically important. So if I'm, you know, trying to optimize my political strategy here, you have to calibrate how much you do in the public. And you have to think congressional open testimony is really about public signaling, fundamentally, right? It's about bringing public awareness on a particular issue, having that motivate news attention and then ultimate civic pressure on legislators. You know, if that's the means to the end, you can have another means to that end, which is just go meet with those legislators, tell them the things that they need to know, so they write into that bill the things you want them to write into that bill. So if the measure of success is, you know, we get things like the Schumer bill, we get things like this, like the Rubio and Gillibrand amendments, well, I mean, that's ultimately the end game here, right? Isn't the spectacle of someone saying something under oath that I go, aha, see, Uncle, you know, Joe, like, I told you, look at this guy, he said it, here's the YouTube clip. That gives you kind of the emotional gratification if that's what you want. If you're thinking a longer game, you need to get statutes, you know, like, kind of codified that the government can't, and that these programs can't wriggle out from. And it seems like if that's my measure of success for this, you know, larger political activity, then it seems to be going very well, right? The progression of from 2022, 2023, 2024 NDAs has been, like, dramatic, I think, in terms of the scale, scope, and intensity of the legislative, you know, attention and pressure on the government to respond on this topic. And so it's a matter of keeping that momentum going. So I see this as just all means to that end. Whether Christopher Mellon or Lozada's testimony supports that trajectory, whether it's better behind the scenes or in public view, I don't know. I'm not the master strategist here. I'm not talking with the NSSCI, you know, staffers who are hearing from a lot of competing interests, right? It isn't just Christopher Malengo meeting with, you know, those professional staff members. It is a whole bunch of Lockheed lobbyists. It's a whole bunch of other people. And that's a high pressure job. And they got a lot of other stuff on their plate. So you have to be pretty discerning in how you approach those interactions and the political strategy. You know, as far as I can tell, whatever they've been doing has sort of worked up until now. So I don't really feel like I'm in a position to armchair quarterback this whole thing and judge from the cheap seats. You know, so far so good. And I don't know, it's a longer game. I have patience here, but I think, you know, the public has a right to tell their legislators, you know, this isn't enough. And so if that's your belief, I would go for it.
We've got a long way to go, but we've made steps. We've made headway, and it's exciting. It's exciting to see the process, and it's interesting to navigate it, to try and understand it. It's an incredible topic. It does deserve real serious scrutiny. It's good to see people like yourself who are clearly intellectual and very professionally driven who want to see answers on this and want to try and alleviate a bit of that stigma in the professional sector. I've had a great time with you, man. It's been really good. Really good. Hope you've had a good time.
Yeah, man, I think we covered quite a bit of territory. So, happy to chat again, but this is great.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think it'd be really good to get you back. I think there's going to be a lot of positive feedback from this. So, thank you so much for spending so much time with me. I think we've crossed over the 2-hour threshold at this point. Slight delay to the beginning of it, but I think we're over 2 hours now.
Yeah, I'll let you know. Dario Justo says hi.
Oh, Dario, yeah, what's up, man? I love that guy.
I'm not close friends, but we have different acquaintances, and I let him know that I was going on. He said he had some beers with you.
He came and met me in Nottingham for the first time. I took him down to we've got a great pub in Nottingham called Ye Old Walk to Jerusalem. No, Ye Old Trip to Jerusalem, and I believe it's the oldest pub in England. It's the oldest pub. It was where the some of the Templar knights actually planned their crusades and went out to Jerusalem. So that's why it's called Ye Old Trip to Jerusalem. It was like a stop-off point on the way. So we sat there and sunk a few beers and had a long conversation about all of these different things. And in fact, just before we were leaving, as we were getting up, these two guys next to us who were obviously just close enough to hear the same kind of conversation that you and me have just had. And they were like, what are you guys talking about? Like, what? I'm sorry, but I've been listening in on this. And like, what are you? And so we were like, right, okay. They bought us another round of beers. And we were like, yeah, just like, down. I've said this before. I've got like a PowerPoint presentation in my head now for this. It's like basically in 2017, the New York Times, you just start going through all of the different checkpoints. And by the end of it, they're just sitting there going, how have I not heard about any of this? And it's like, dude, that's the real big mystery, right? Why is there not international media frenzy over this? Why is it not in the headlines? So I always find it quite jarring when you come across people who have never heard of Fravor, the Tic Tac, Nimitz, none of it. It's all new to them. All new.
Yeah, I see. It's very early on. Like, I try to find analogies because they're helpful. But like, I remember in like January 2020, I was in a role where like I had colleagues that were supporting certain parts of the government were doing like early like biosurveillance detection.
Right.
They have parts that's like health related, parts of like are intelligence related. So like I knew something was squirrely like early in January. And I couldn't say to everyone like why I knew this was going to be a big deal. But I was trying to tell people like, you know, this, like, and I told my wife, I was like, we're going to Costco. And she's like, are you sure? And like, I told people at my work who are into this, like, they were like planning meetings in like March. I was like, that's not gonna happen. I was like, and I was like, we're going pretty soon. And so you got this like crazy look, right? And it's because there's like, but there's two types of those people, right? There's like the person who's either, you know, plugged in, so to speak, right? Who's got access to has an information asymmetry, right? Who knows things that other people don't know about that particular issue and is taking actions on it. There's other people who are just hyper reactive to anything. Right, who are just predisposed to conspiracy-minded, you know, wild stuff, who might also say the same things, and so it's kind of hard to distinguish between,
right,
like the Looney Tunes guy,
yeah, dude,
is like really like getting ready for some stuff, right? And so it depends on like where you are in that like epistemic journey or like what you need to know this information for. Like if you really just need to go about your daily life, I don't think you necessarily need to pay too much attention to this. It's just like people have to pay bills. People have to take their kids to school. Until it lands on their front lawn, it's like, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Just adding more cognitive psychological baggage that I already deal with because I'm like stressing out about, you know, everything else in my life. Like this isn't helping me. So like it's sort of rational to ignore it. But if you're in a position where you need to like be ahead of the curve, then like you kind of have to like dig in. And there's sort of this like, you know, like the like the bell curve, like there's like that midwit normie who is like sometimes they over anchor on like, okay, it has to go through these filters before I will take anything seriously.
Right.
Rational strategy for the most part. But it also means that if you're gonna be surprised by a left tail event, you're gonna be really surprised. Right? So that's sort of the trade off you're making with that setting your analytic framework up like that.
Is you
that
cue Neil deGrasse Tyson's ontological shock that's coming.
For you, it's gonna be like a real slap in the face.
Right.
Because you set yourself up so that only things that meet a very high bar of external third-party mainstream validation, you know, make it through to you, right? And so by the time this thing is coming, it is a meteor like at your like at your head, right? Whereas other folks that may be more, you know, willing to go out, right, to like have less filters, right? That's a different trade-off. It means a lot more things come in that can mess with how you orient yourself in the world, right? It might make you bad at cocktail parties. It might make you someone who is racked with anxiety a lot because you're paying attention to lots of crazy things. And you don't know how to distinguish between the serious and the not serious. And so everything is like, you know, important and it's really hard to operate in that way psychologically. So these are all trade-offs. It's very, you know, I wouldn't tell anyone how to structure their own filters, but yeah, like if this is the case that it is a real thing, then those people are going to be in for a real surprise. And yeah, there could be social consequences for that because if a lot of those people are in positions of responsibility and professional, you know, like our managerial class, what do they do, right? When they actually have this recognition, do they show up for work? That seems like an important question we need to answer. Like, I would be worried if there was like a several percentage points of the population, especially in positions of like that PMC class that's like running our banking system, financial system, or healthcare system, that just have a nervous breakdown.